Right. Well, first of all, I want to thank everyone for being here. I want to thank the Purdue North Central Veterans Club, work of Mark Strudis, and the grant that we have accessed at PNC is making this possible. So the Purdue North Central Veterans Club, the work of Mark Strudis, the work of those in the Dean of Students Office, particularly Diane, John Coggins, I want to thank him. Also, Linda. I want to thank the Thomas Library. This is a public space. Anyone who lives in Westchester Township, you can rent this space for free. Okay, this is a free public space. It's open to anyone, and you can use it in any fashion you wish, as long as you're not making a profit. Since we aren't making a profit on this event, what we are asking is for donations. I'll probably ask Derek to give a shoot for the donations as well. But we are asking for whatever you can give. If you can give a dollar, if you can give $5, if you can give $100, it's great. But we appreciate anything that anyone can give. I also obviously want to thank Derek for being here. I wanted to begin with a short intro, because one of the things I joked about with Derek before the event was every time I go on YouTube to find one of my favorite thinkers who's giving a talk, there's always some asshole giving a 20-minute introductory speech. And I just want to get to the person who everyone wants to hear from. But I did want to mention a couple things. One sort of a journey of how we got here today on an individual level. So for myself, how I became turned on to Derek's work. Going to Iraq, experiencing what occupation is about, having to take people's lives, these are things I've talked about at length in other spaces, so I won't talk about them at length here. Having some of my best friends killed, and then beginning this critique, a very limited critique. What are we doing in Iraq? What does American foreign policy stand for? What are the actions that our tax dollars are paying for overseas? And why was I involved? So it started smart. It started small, and I think in many ways started in a selfish fashion. I was upset because of what I had been through. I was upset because of what we put the Iraqi people through. After that, I came home, became involved with minority rights groups, labor groups, environmental groups, LGBTQ community, and all kinds of organizations on the left that I think are valuable and absolutely essential. But then I kept digging further, and I thought, what is it? Is it imperialism? Well, what's imperialism connected to? Imperialism is connected to capitalism. Okay, what's in capitalism rely on? It relies on the extraction and exploitation of resources and labor, but more importantly, those resources. And so then I got turned on to Derek's work, and I thought, well, no, it's not just capitalism. I thought it's the entire civilization and the entire culture that tells us that it's humans first, that it's males first, that it's the straight first, that we have the right to dominate, to exploit, and to extract wherever we wish. And this is what the entire culture and our entire civilization has been founded on. And this is what Derek's work does. Derek's work forces people to think about these issues in a fundamentally radical way. And I think Derek's work should be essential to anyone who's involved with any kind of movements on the left, and anyone who's interested in saving this planet or saving what we can of this planet. I think his work is absolutely necessary, and I think it's essential. So I'm asking that you listen with an open heart, with an open mind, and there will be time for Q&A afterwards, and Derek will clarify and answer any questions you wish. So I want to thank everyone for coming out today. I appreciate it. And I think this work is absolutely necessary, but it couldn't happen without all of us working together and making these things happen. So I want to thank you, and I hope you take what Derek has to say with the utmost seriousness. So thank you.
So how's the volume? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Vince left off the most important part about when some asshole gives an introduction, which is that basically I think you've encapsulated everything I have to say, and I don't see how I can really follow. So thank you so much for coming out. Good evening. Thanks for ringing me. Let's go over to the burger joint. And and you know, last couple days I have in the last really 27 hours thing, I've pretty much fallen in love with Vince and Sergio and the rest of the crew. And when I look around, I don't see very much that gives me very much optimism. And the conversations with your whole group the last couple days have I mean, I'm certainly not going to call it optimism, but it's really great to encounter young people who are so smart and so committed and so, and have not only direct personal experience of what it means to have direct experience of the costs of empire, but who at the same time can throw out the names of all sorts of theorists that I don't have any idea who the fuck they're talking about. Yeah, they were throwing out all sorts of names yesterday, and because I'm a writer and because I'm supposed to know this shit, I'm like, they're like, what do you think of blah, blah? And I'm like, yeah, their first book was really good, and then their fourth book was passable, and let's change the subject. Anyway, so I've just been I've been thoroughly impressed, and if there is to be a serious resistance movement, I think that my perspective on the possibility of a serious resistance movement in this country has moved from the odds being about 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 7,500, which is good. That's good for one day. So if we could just do this every day, pretty soon we'd be a 1 in 1,000. Okay, so I would like to thank all of you for coming out. And then I would also like to thank the Purdue North Central Veterans Club. And I would like to thank Mark and Linda and Diana and John and Sergio. And just because I'm going to be a jerk, like three times I asked Vince to write down his name and he refused. So I would also like to thank Vince. I think we should all just applaud him to bug the shit out of him. I'd like to thank the Library Service Center. I would like to thank Celeste, Veterans Unplugged Radio, Matt, Matt, Johnny, Rick, and I would like to also put out again the plea for donations. And I'm sorry, did you say that Derek was going to give a shoe when you were talking about we're all going to give donations, or you asked for donations and you said, I think Derek's going to give a shoe?
A
shout out. I was like, I could if I was home, but I don't. The only people who can ask for my shoes when I'm on the road are TSA people. So anyway, before we actually start with what we're doing, how many people have heard my Endgame talk? This is about half. Because Vince asked me specifically to do the Endgame talk, and were it not for the existence of YouTube, I would be delighted to do so. Because I always get kind of jealous of musicians because, you know, 40-some years later, Led Zeppelin can still play Stairway to Heaven and everybody gets all excited. But, you know, it's like, oh, fuck, the Endgame talk again. God damn it. Anyway, it's really hard because, and Vince and I talked about this some, that well, what we're going to do is we're going to do the Endgame talk, and then after that, we'll do a Q&A. So those of you who are like, oh, shit, the Endgame talk, go ahead, get out a book, go to sleep, take a walk. And part of the reason for this is that I think our discourse is absurd enough that we need to cover this ground, and we need to keep covering it, because when you have environmentalists claiming that windmills are sustainable, or, I mean, it's like we got to keep going back to ground zero or keep going back to first principles, because obviously there's some stuff we're not getting. Okay, so having said that, the Endgame talk itself is a little over 2 hours, so we'll do that, and then we'll take a couple minutes off, and then we'll come back for Q&A. And it's like, holy shit, 2 fucking hours. But okay, so I don't know if you know this, but the first draft of the movie Star Wars was actually not written by George Lucas and company. The first draft of the movie Star Wars was written by environmentalists, and it was quite a bit different than the way the movie eventually turned out. And is there anybody in here who does not know the plot of Star Wars? One? Are you scratching your head, or are you sort of embarrassedly? Okay. So there's one person who doesn't know. Okay, usually it's, yeah, and she's looking around like, I'm so embarrassed. It's always the same. It's like, it's, oh, that's great. Well, now you're scratching your head, though. It's like, no, I wasn't raising my hand. You know, I just wrote an essay not very long ago. God, the Endgame talk's going to be 3 hours now because I'm rambling all over. But I just wrote an essay maybe a couple months ago about, you know, I've been saying for years that we don't live in a democracy. And, I mean, it's pretty clear. I mean, you just ask, you know, it's like, how many people in here believe that we live in a democracy? Bunch of fucking communists. You know, it's like, it's pretty extraordinary that, you know, the world's greatest democracy and nobody, I mean, it's not just radicals or anything. I mean, seriously, if you ask people on, okay, I'll take a dare right now. I will ask somebody on the plane tomorrow, the person I'm sitting next to, I will ask them, I do this all the time, I will ask them, do you believe that the government takes better care of human beings or corporations? I will ask that question tomorrow. And I guarantee that they will say it takes better care of corporations. But I just wrote an essay saying that I actually do believe that we live in a form of democracy. And the thing that convinces me we live in a form of democracy is tigers. And what I mean by that is not actually living, breathing tigers. What I mean by that are the Louisiana State University Tigers football team. Because at last year's college BCS championship game, there were about 70,000 people went to the football game, and they paid an average of $1,500 apiece. And there were 14 million people who watched this game on television. And how many people do you think would show up at the Superdome to pay $1,500 to protect real tigers? One? Zero? It's the same with the fucking Detroit Tigers, you know? It's like, there are more people. I love sports, you know, but it drives me fucking nuts that you can turn on. So who's playing tonight? It's probably blasphemy that I actually can't say off the top of my head. Kentucky's playing, right? Holy shit, we have a whole room of a bunch of communists? Anyway, It breaks my heart that you can turn on a sporting event and you'll see, you know, 40,000 people in there. There's 40,000 people go see the fucking Detroit Tigers or Chicago Cubs or something. And, sorry to raise a painful subject. And how many people, it's like, there was a great example. This is an example I give quite a bit. I live in far northern California, and when you think of far northern California, what is the first agricultural product you think of?
Weed.
Yeah. And in California, there's this thing called Prop 215, which means you can have marijuana for personal medicinal use. And the amount you can have is determined county by county. And some counties, like Orange County, which is very conservative, you're allowed to have a maximum of 6 plants. Mm-hmm. And counties like Del Norte, where I live, you were allowed to have a maximum of 99 plants for personal medicinal use. And there are those who thought that was excessive. And so the county board of supervisors was going to lower the number from 99 down to 6. Board of supervisors, that's what we have in California. That's not they have. That's what the government has in California is board of supervisors. County commissioners, is that what you have here? Who runs the county? But not corporations. Fuck Monsanto. Like, who? Is it commissioners? Yeah, okay. So board of supervisors or county commissioners, same deal. Anyway, so at the board of supervisors meeting that night, they were going to reduce from 99 to 6, and the place was packed. And this is how participatory democracy is supposed to work. That had the supervisors reduced it from 99 to 6, they would have been killed. It was angry marijuana patients and potheads, and you usually think about potheads being really cool and groovy, but just, yeah, don't take away the pot. And, okay, so this was wonderful and glorious, an example of participatory democracy. The bad news is that every time these board of supervisors attempt to do something that harms salmon, 3 people show up. I wish that people loved the salmon as much as they love marijuana. So the point is there's a sense in which we do have a democracy, in a democracy of action, in that more people honestly care about the Louisiana State University Tigers than care about living, breathing tigers, and more people care about their access to marijuana than care about salmon. I realize that's not a real dichotomy, because you can care about marijuana and salmon too, but the point is that there were people who got off their fucking butts to actually do something, as opposed to for the salmon again. So there's a sense in which I think we really do live in a democracy. If you wanted a revolution in this country, it's pretty simple. You could do one of 2 things. Pop the price of gas up to $10 a gallon. People will be in the streets tomorrow. Another thing you could do, cut off TV. And I'm not saying this about, well, yeah, it's great to cut off TV, but what would happen is it would be the wrong revolution. People would be having a revolution to get the TV. It's like, how dare you take away Dancing with the Stars? You know, you can actually give my family cancer. You can murder the planet I live on. But don't you dare take away Judge Judy. We could actually do a pretty interesting sort of feminist analysis of Judge Judy, by the way. I think one reason for her popularity, I think she represents the crone. She's an older woman who dispenses justice and doesn't take any shit. And I think that she has a large demographic of disempowered women who recognize a sort of... I would love to see Jane Caputi, who's written absolutely great feminist books, I would love to see Jane Caputi do a take on Judge Judy. It's neither here nor there. Okay, anyway, so the plot of Star Wars is that... And that's the point, is everybody in this room, except for you, knows the plot of Star Wars. And, you know, how many of us can name 5 species of shellfish who are native to here who have been driven extinct? And I guarantee that there's at least 5 species of mussels who have been driven extinct here. But we can't. We'll get there later. So the plot of Star Wars is... the movie came out, actually, before I get the plot, and you're already seeing why my books are written in a nonlinear fashion. It came out in 1977, I believe, which was the perfect time for it to come out, for me at least, because I was a sophomore, I believe, in high school, and I remember my friends went to see it, I went to see it. We all just thought it was great. We had to all then tell all of our other friends, oh my God, this movie is so good, you know, and the acting is so great, you can't even believe it. And, you know, we weren't those nerds who see it 1,000 times or anything. I mean, for one thing, we weren't nerds. And for another thing, we were way too busy playing Dungeons and Dragons. So the plot is that the Empire has built this giant machine called the Death Star. And the Death Star is a machine that's capable of destroying entire planets, which is actually a wonderful metaphor for the dominant culture. It's a machine that's capable of destroying an entire planet. Anyway, so the Empire builds this Death Star, and then the rebels figure out a way to destroy the Death Star, and then Luke Skywalker uses the Force to get past all the TIE fighters and then drop a torpedo down a thermal exhaust... I was kind of a nerd. Anyway, drop a torpedo down a thermal exhaust port and blows up Death Star, and that's pretty much the end of the movie, and I've ruined it for you now. Sorry. But it's actually still worth seeing for the acting. And so that's the plot. And that was the plot as it ended up being, but the plot as the environmentalists actually wrote it in the first place was a little bit different. For one thing, they didn't actually call it Star Wars. They called it Star Nonviolent Civil Disobedience. And for another, in this version, the environmentalist version, they didn't actually blow up the Death Star, but instead they used other tactics to slow the intergalactic march of empire. For example, they set up programs for people on planets about to be destroyed to produce luxury items like hemp hacky sacks and gourmet coffee for sale to inhabitants of the Death Star. Audience members will also discover that there are plans afoot to encourage loads of troopers and other citizens of the Empire to take eco-tours of the doomed planets. Their purpose will be to show to one and all that these planets are economically important to the Empire and so should not be destroyed. In a surprise move that will get viewers to the edge of their seats, other groups of rebels file lawsuits against the Empire, attempting to show that the environmental impact statement that Darth Vader was required to file failed to adequately support his decision that blowing up the planet would cause no significant impact. Viewers will thrill to learn of plans to boycott items produced by the corporations that have Darth Vader on the board of directors, and they'll leap to their feet in theaters worldwide when they see bags full of letters written directly to Mr. Vader himself, asking that he please not blow up any more planets. Scribbled in the margin is a note from one of the screenwriters. For accuracy's sake, when we show examples of these letters, it is imperative that all letters to Mr. Vader be respectful and courteous, but they stress the need to find cooperative solutions to the differences between the rebels and the Empire. Under no circumstances should the letters be such that they would alienate or anger Mr. Vader. If the letters upset Mr. Vader, the rebels' letter campaign to the Grand Moff Tarkin will certainly fail as well. Other plans include sending petitions and filing lawsuits. Now, we all know that that would be sufficient not only to bring the Empire to its knees, but to make a damn fine and exciting movie. The thing is, there's more. Thousands of renegade rebels, unhappy with what they perceive as toadying on the part of the mainstream rebels, decide, in a scene guaranteed to bring tears to the eyes of even the most cold-hearted theatergoers, to stand on the planets about to be destroyed, link arms, and sing Give Peace a Chance. They send DVDs to both Darth Vader and his boss, the Grand Moff Tarkin, to whom they also send wave after wave of loving kindness. A few of the rebels sneak aboard the Death Star and they lock themselves down to various pieces of equipment. And then stirring debates are held on screen among these rebels to whether they should voluntarily surrender on approach of the troopers or whether they should remain locked down to the end. And in a brilliant and brave touch of authenticity, the rebels are never able to come to consensus. Once inside the Death Star, there's a splinter group that breaks off from those about to lock themselves down. They rush down a bunch of hallways, and they avoid all the troopers. They burn a couple transports, and they use chemicals to etch Galaxy Liberation Front on the walls of the Death Star. That group... blah, blah, blah. Near the end of the movie, there's a debate held among the rebels. And that was actually a problem I had with the environmentalist version of Star Wars, is that there was a bit too much debate and not quite enough action. I'm just saying. As the Death Star looms directly overhead, there's a few of the rebels actually advocate picking up weapons to fight back. And those rebels are generally shouted down by the pacifist rebels, who argue that attacking those who run the Death Star is just another example of the Empire's harmful philosophy coming in by the back door. They state that the rebels who want to fight back are simply doing so because they themselves have been traumatized. And they're saying that because they have been co-opted by the need to control things. If we want to change Darth Vader, they say, we must first become that change ourselves. To change Darth Vader's heart, we must first change our own. We must above all else have compassion for Darth Vader and remember that he too was once a child. One writer put in the margins, excellent, that will be sure to moisten the cheeks of sensitive people everywhere. He didn't mention whether or not these tears would be of frustration. Anyway, finally, Lilu, Conjubac, and a couple of robots show up, and they tell the others they found a way to blow up the whole Death Star. And everybody else is just absolutely horrified. They say that you, Lilu, Khan, Chewbacca, are heartless and cruel. So in the exciting final scene of the environmentalist version, there's a scuffle breaks out between Luke, Leia, Han, Chewbacca on one side and the pacifists on the other. And at last, the pacifists chase those four from the room and then from the film. And they're never seen again, which is not a big deal since they're minor characters anyway. So the Death Star looms closer and closer. And audience members chew their fingernails. They wait to see whether the letters and petitions and lawsuits work their magic. So viewers see the lasers inside the Death Star warming up to destroy the planet. These lasers glow this hellish red, and the camera switches to cover the planet, and then it goes back to show the Death Star, and then the planet, and the Death Star, and then the planet, and then psh, there's a little spark of light. And what that is? That's the environmentalists getting away before the planet gets blown up, and then there's the final shot of the movie. Is this place gets blown up. And the final shot of the movie, which reveals what a complete triumph this was for the rebels, is a still showing an article on the lower left of page 43 of the New Empire Times that devotes a full three sentences to the destruction of the planet. So it's like, yeah, we got some press. That's the end of the story. This, by the way, is how I know we will not have a revolution, because if people will pay for water bottled in plastic, they will suffer any indignity. So a few years ago, I was doing a talk down in North Carolina. And after the talk, this one guy, during the Q&A, this one guy said, so how many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb? And I said, I don't know, I'll bite. How many? And he said, this wasn't a riddle. I was actually asking you a question. It's like, that's not how that's supposed to work. And so I went back to my hotel after the show, and I was obsessing about that question, which says far more about my social life than I want it to. And I finally came up with an answer. How many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is 10. One to write the light bulb a letter requesting that it change. Four to circulate online petitions. One to file a lawsuit demanding that it change. One to send the light bulb loving kindness, knowing that's the only way real change occurs. One to accept the light bulb precisely the way it is, clear in the knowledge that to not accept another is to do great harm to oneself. One to write a bunch of books about how and why the light bulb needs to change. And finally, one to smash the fucking light bulb, because we all know it's never going to change. Wait. Light bulb? Culture? We'll go on. Okay. So, as a longtime grassroots environmental activist, and as a creature living in the thrashing endgame of civilization, I am intimately acquainted with the landscape of loss, and I've grown accustomed to carrying the daily weight of despair. I've walked clear cuts that wrap around mountains and drop into valleys and climb ridges to fragment watershed after watershed, and I've sat silent near empty streams that two generations ago were lashed into whiteness by uncountable salmon coming home to spawn and die. Several years ago, I began to feel pretty apocalyptic, but I hesitated to use that word, in part because of those cartoons I've seen of crazy penitents carrying the end is near signs, and in part because of the power of the word itself, apocalypse. I didn't want to use it lightly. And then a friend and fellow activist said to me, so Derek, what's it going to take for you to finally use that word? Will it take the death of flocks of passenger pigeons so large they darken the sky for days at a time? They were here. Will it take the death? And they were flying, they would fly 60 miles an hour and sound like rolling thunder. Will it take the death of flocks of Eskimo curlews that were just as large? Maybe it'll take the death of runs of salmon that were so thick that people were afraid to put their boats in the water for fear they would capsize. So thick that you could hear them for miles before you'd see them. So thick that horses are afraid to get in the water. So thick. The Indians of the Northwest, one of the things they used to do for fun is they would toss a pebble into a river, and then they would count how long it would take for the pebble to touch the bottom, because it would float on the backs of the salmon. And it might take a couple minutes for it to go through. And maybe it'll take that. Maybe it'll take 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. You know, I did a talk one time in Portland. And after the talk, this one guy came up to me and said, you know, my friend says, he was, of course, talking about himself, my friend says that it's not time to fight back yet. And I said, okay, 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. Where is it? It's like, I said, stop me when it gets to be time to fight back. 91%, 92%, 93% of large fish in the ocean's gone, 94, 95, 96, 97, 98, 99, 100% of large fish. And they said to me, you know, I don't think it'll ever be time to fight back. And I said, what are we talking about then? You know, I'll talk to somebody else. So at what, you know, I don't know how it is here. I've lived where I live now for 12 years. And in the last 12 years, even 6 years ago, the frogs outside in the spring were so loud that you couldn't have a human conversation. And the frogs are gone. This year's actually an okay year. I can hear them. But there's maybe a half dozen frogs now, as opposed to being so loud you couldn't hear them. In the last 10 years, moth populations have collapsed, hummingbird populations have collapsed, songbird populations have collapsed, banana slug populations have collapsed, newt populations. I used to see a half dozen newts a day, and I've talked to old-timers who used to routinely see 100 newts a day. This year I've seen one newt so far. So my friend said, you know, at what point are you finally going to use the word? What will it take for you to finally call it an apocalypse? What's it going to take? Where's your threshold? You know, there used to be, everybody knows what penguins are, right? Does anybody know why there aren't any penguins in the Northern Hemisphere? They used to be. They were called the great auk. And the Portuguese called them penguins because it means the fat one. And they were these seabirds they're penguins. They're flightless seabirds in the Northern Hemisphere. And there were so many that on just one island in the North Atlantic, there were so many that one French explorer said that you could load every ship in France with them and it wouldn't make a dent. Well, they did, and it did make a dent. And the last one was killed in the 19th century. And so once again, what's it going to take for you to finally call it an apocalypse? And the question I ask all the time is, why are we losing so badly? I think there's a bunch of reasons that we so often lose. One of them, I believe, is because I think a lot of us don't really know what we want. I get so tired of so many environmentalists who say explicitly that what they are attempting to save is capitalism. And, I mean, think about it. All of the so-called solutions to global warming that we hear from the mainstream, what do they all have in common? What they all have in common is they take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world is that which must conform to industrial capitalism. That is literally insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality. Because I hate to break the news, but without a real world, you don't have any social system whatsoever. The real world must be primary. And so one of the reasons that we lose is because a lot of us don't really know what we want. You know, what do we want? Do we want smaller clear cuts, kinder clear cuts? Do we want for them not to frack in a 15-foot radius from where we actually live? Do we want for our water only to catch on fire one day out of five? What is it that we want? And, you know, I was just doing a talk up in Michigan, and one of the questions was, why do we not have an effective revolt against capitalism? And part of my answer was, I don't think you can talk about tactics. No. The question was, how would we do an effective result, a revolt? And I said, before you can have a revolt, you have to think about, before you can think about how, you have to think about what. What is it you want? Before you can talk about tactics, you got to talk about strategy. And before you can talk about strategy, you have to talk about what it is you want. You got to talk about goals. And I don't think a lot of us are really clear on what we want. I'm very clear on what I want. I want to live in a world that has more wild salmon every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world with more migratory songbirds every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world with more large fish in the oceans every year than the year before. There is 6 to 10 times as much plastic as there is phytoplankton in the oceans. This would be like every time you go to eat a bite of food, 6 out of 7 bites or 10 out of 11 bites are plastic. And I want to live in a world with less plastic in the world every year. I want to live in a world with less dioxin in every mother's breast milk every year than the year before. I was talking just a couple days ago to a good friend of mine from India who does a lot of restoration work, a lot of physical restoration work. And she does beautiful, wonderful work. And she and a whole bunch of others, I don't remember the number, if it was 15,000 or 150,000 has to be 15,000 because it was just in a few days. They took out her and a few others, took out 15,000 invasive pine trees in the area where they were to restore some grass, to help restore some grasslands. And it's beautiful, wonderful work, but wouldn't it be nice if the world was actually being restored as opposed to that being this much? And at the same time, there are mines going in a half mile away that are destroying 1,000 times as much. And I want to live in a world being restored. I want to live in a world where the carbon is actually going down, the atmospheric carbon is actually going down, which, by the way, even not getting rid of industrialization, which we'll talk about in a while, the next 2 hours, but even not getting rid of that, the United States could become a carbon sink very easily. All they'd have to do is restore all prairie and forest east of the Mississippi River, and they could maintain industrialism. That's how much the world wants to live, is when they talk about, it's like several years ago, Richard Branson, is that the guy's name? Virgin Airlines? Branson, is that it? Branson. He put out this thing saying that he would give, I don't know, $1 million or something to anybody who could figure out some device that would sequester carbon and be cost effective and environmentally safe and everything. And yeah, exactly. You're going to steal my idea. And I wrote him a letter that said, trees, you can send the check too. I didn't hear back. And so anyway, part of the reason we lose is because I don't think a lot of us really know what we want. And then another part of the reason we lose is because, as environmentalists, we lose is because, how many people in here have read Robert J. Lipton's great book, The Nazi Doctors? A fabulous, fabulous book. In this book, he takes the, it's one of the probably 20 most important books I ever read. And in this book, he takes his basic idea is that he wanted to ask the question, how is it that men in this case, who had taken the Hippocratic Oath, could go work in a death camp? How could they do that? And what he found is that there were some like Mengele who were just horrible sadists, and we'll put them aside. And but he said that most of them actually cared very deeply for the health of the inmates, and they would do whatever they could to help them. They would, if they were in pain, they would give them an aspirin to lick. They would hide them from selection officers who were going to kill them. They would put them to bed for a day or two. They would, did I mention that they'd give them a scrap of potato to eat if they're starving, which they were always starving? They would do everything they could except for the most important thing of all, which is they wouldn't question the existence of the death camp itself. They wouldn't question the larger superstructure that was causing it. And as environmentalists, we, and I include myself, do the same thing. We do everything we can to save this or that creature we love or this or that piece of ground that we love. We do everything we can except for the most important thing of all, which is to question the larger superstructure that is working the planet to death, that is gassing the planet to death. And that's not good enough. It's not good enough for me for a few more generations of bobcat or salmon or lampreys to live out harried lives before they ultimately get exterminated. You know, a metaphor I think about, or an analogy or whatever the hell it is, that I think about all the time is that every year my mom gets a couple cords of firewood, which then gets stacked in her garage, and then I carry firewood in for her every day in the winter into the house. And every day I pick up a piece of firewood and I look at it for spiders, and then I knock them off on the rest of the pile. But I am fully aware, so I don't burn them to death, and I am fully aware as I'm doing this that I am merely putting off their execution date because eventually she goes through the whole pile. And it's the same. You know, we were talking last night about a really good book called Gunfighter Nation by Richard Slotkin, which is the basic idea is that he follows popular fiction from 1780 through 1980 or something. And the basic idea is how, in this popular fiction, in the 1780s, the popular fiction would be about how white people want to fight fair against the Indians, but the Indians they never fight fair, which means just this once the white people have to fight dirty. And in the 1930s, it was that the white people want to fight fair, United States people want to fight fair, but the Mexicans fight dirty. So just this once, the white people have to fight dirty. 1870s, American Indians fight dirty, so just this once, white people got to fight dirty. 1900, white people want to fight fair. The Filipinos, they fight dirty, so just this once, we got to fight dirty. Which didn't happen in the Civil War, didn't happen in World War One, because it's white people. Didn't happen in World War II, it happened with the Japanese with popular fiction. Didn't happen with the Germans so much. And 1970s, 1960s and early 70s, you know, the United States always wants to fight fair, but those goddamn Vietnamese, you know, they fight dirty. So just this once, we got to fight dirty. And this is true with cop movies, too. You know, it's like Dirty Harry. Dirty Harry wants to be clean, but those fucking bad guys, they fight dirty. So just this once, Dirty Harry's got to fight dirty. And I don't know, have we heard this rhetoric lately about how, you know, the United States does not want to torture, but those fucking Arabs, you know, they fight dirty. So just this once, we got to fight dirty. And this is also the classic line of abusers. It's this exceptionalism. And it's never a pattern. That's the thing. There's a great line by Melon Kundera, which is, the struggle against oppression is the struggle of memory against forgetting. The struggle against oppression is the struggle of memory against forgetting. Because if the abusers can make you not recognize the pattern, you can say, okay, it's okay. They can put in the Keystone XL. They're not going to do anything else. Okay, they can put in one more oil well. They can't do anything else. Oh, the BLM is fucking up Desolation Canyon in Utah. Well, that's okay. It's the last one, you know. Just this once, they got to make an exception to environmental rules. You know, but it's consistent. Anyway, so everything is about us. Everything in an abusive system is aimed toward people not seeing the pattern. You know, I don't know about you, but it's so funny. I was talking about this yesterday, and you were kind of laughing, I hope with me, when I read Chomsky, I was like, seriously, United States is an imperial power? Really? I mean, Chomsky, there are a lot of bad things that Chomsky could probably do. I'm not saying he does, but he could do a lot of bad things just because he taught me that. You know, it's like he gains a lot of cred for that. It's like, and I can't believe I was so stupid. It took me until I was like older than you. It took me until I was like 29 or something to figure out the U.S. is an imperial power. I'm not always very smart. Okay. Anyway, so the next question, you know, why do we lose? Another question always is, and this is a question that underlies a lot of my work, is, do you believe the culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? No. Nobody ever says yes. A lot of people laugh. And the question becomes, if you don't believe the culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And the answer is, we don't know. And the reason we don't know is because we don't talk about it. And the reason we don't talk about it is because we're all so busy pretending that we have hope. And I'm going to bash hope later. It's one of my favorite things to do. And but in any case, it's a huge, important question that we need to ask, that we're not asking. Okay, so what I want to do for the rest of the Endgame talk is to go through some of the premises of Endgame. One of the things I did with Endgame is I laid out the premises before I began the book. And one of the reasons I did that is because sort of one of the first rules of propaganda is, if you can slide your premises by people, you've got them. I didn't want to do that. What I mean by this is, Hitler's a great example, that one of the things Hitler asked was, what are we going to do about the Jewish problem? And a lot of people responded, gosh, Adolf, that's a really good question. What are we going to do about the Jewish problem? But what he's done is he slid by the premise that there was a Jewish problem they had to do something about. But of course, that was a long time ago, and people don't do that anymore. Except, for example, like if you hear some talking head on television saying, how can we make the U.S. economy grow? Good question. How can we make the U.S. economy grow? Well, premise one, we want the U.S. economy to grow. Premise two, we want the U.S. economy to exist. Premise three, who the hell's we? And so I don't want to slide the premises by you like that. So I'm gonna lay out some of them as clearly as I can. So the first premise is that industrial civilization is not and can never be sustainable. Industrial civilization is not and can never be sustainable. several years ago, I was riding around in a car with a friend of mine, George Straffen, and I was just making conversation. I said, so George, if you could live at any level of technology that you wanted, what would it be? And George was not in a very good mood that day, and he said, Derek, that's a really stupid question. Thank you, George. This is why we're not going to write very many more books together. Anyway, he said, that's a really stupid question, because we can fantasize whatever we want, but the only level of technology that's ever been sustainable is the Stone Age. And we will be living again at the Stone Age someday, and the only question is what's left of the world when we get there. And he's right. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of living that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. In fact, I would say it takes anybody but a rocket scientist to figure that out. So if you have basically, if you have 1,000 units of something, and then you use them and you base your way of life on them, and then you have 900, and then you have 800, and then 700, eventually you're gonna run out. And you would think that if you have an entire way of life that's based on the use of, I don't know, let's take a random example, oil, that you would ask yourself what you're going to do when the oil runs out. And it's not just oil. It's rare earths. It's zinc. It's aluminum. It's Richard Heinberg wrote a very good book called Peak Everything. And so if you have, which... it's not merely oil that is being used up. Sometimes people ask, what would it take for everyone in the world to live at a United States standard of living? Well, 9 more Earths or 32 more Earths or something. I mean, it's not merely oil that makes that not possible. It's also aluminum. Bauxite. It's also many, many other copper. It's many, many other materials that would not. I mean, it's embarrassing that I have to sit here and say that any way of life based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. I mean, it embarrasses me to even say that. Okay, the first thing. But I'm going to take it a step further, which is, in addition, any way of life that is based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources won't last. If every year there are fewer salmon returned than the year before, eventually there will be none. And anybody who is not head of the National Marine Fisheries Services can understand this. That's a joke that works better in the Northwest. So if this year there's 1,000 salmon, or if this year there's 100, it's like up in the Fraser River. I just read this a few days ago. A couple years ago was a great run of salmon for the Fraser River, and it was, I believe, 3 million fish. Might have been 30 million. I don't know. It was a lot of fish, and that sounds wonderful until you actually read what the runs were 100 years ago, which was more than 100 million fish. And so this fabulous run was, I believe, 3% of what the historical runs were. There were runs of salmon. I just read this not very long ago. Even in the 1930s, there was a run of salmon in Alaska that was 12 miles wide and lasted for 30 days. And so once again, if every year there are fewer passenger pigeons return, eventually there'll be none. For a way of life to be sustainable, you have to not be harming the land base. This, where I live now, is occupied Talawa land, Talawa Indians. And the Talawa lived there for 12,500 years, if you believe in the myths of science. And if you believe in the myths of the Talawa, then they lived there since the beginning of time. But in either case, they lived there for a really long time. And they did so sustainably. Oh, I was doing a talk at Princeton several years ago. It's pretty funny. I was doing a talk at Princeton, and I said this thing about the Talawa. And this one guy said, just because they lived there for 12,500 years does not mean that they were living there sustainably. I said, okay, why? And he said, well, because we don't have any quantitative analysis that shows that there's the same number of salmon now as there were 12,500 years ago. I said, you're a science major, aren't you? Wrong audience. Anyway, so the point is that we have been told that evolution is based on survival of the fittest, which means survival of the meanest, which means the survival of the most competitive, which means basically the survival of the most capitalist. And to show how stupid our discourse is, I can disprove that in one sentence if you give me a couple semicolons, which is those creatures who've survived in the long run have survived in the long run, semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings, semicolon. You survive in the long run by actually improving your habitat. That's what salmon do. They make a forest a better place by their existence. That's what bears do. That's what all of us, that's what the Talawa did. Otherwise, they wouldn't have lived there for 12,500 years. So I really like what Dolores LaChapelle said, that it's not survival of the fittest, it's survival of the fit, which is how well you fit into your surroundings. And this is all basic patriarchal stuff, that instead of the way you survive is by entering into a relationship. The way you survive is by conforming yourself to them, not demanding that they conform themselves to you. It's like I just wrote a book last year called Dreams, and it's my best attack yet on science. And one of the things I mention in there is that Richard Dawkins says that, this is a direct quote, science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and to predict what will happen and when. Science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and to predict what will happen and when. Which, pretty smart guy, you know, when you flip a switch, stuff goes on. Obviously, science is true. But what he's done is he has conflated the ability to dominate with what is true. That's really fucking sneaky. And it's really, really messed up. This culture, the domination, the impulse to dominate in this culture is so deep that it goes to our very epistemology, which is always a word that I've wanted to use in a talk. And please forgive me. One of the many things he doesn't understand is that one form of knowledge can foreclose other forms of knowledge. And a way to show this is, let's pretend I got a gun. And nothing personal, but I'm going to aim a gun at you. Okay, so let's pretend I got a gun, and let's pretend I aim it at you. Let's pretend there's a hoop right here. And I say, on the count of three, you're going to jump through this hoop, or I'm going to shoot you. So on the count of three, you jump through the hoop. What do you know? I'm a fucking genius. Because I predict he's going to jump through the hoop, and he did. But isn't it possible that by me aiming a gun at you, if I aimed a gun at you and made you jump through a hoop, and I did this repeatedly, would you still want to be my friend? Would it not be possible that by forcing you to do this, that I had foreclosed any possibility of friendship between us? I don't know about you, but if somebody points a gun at my head and tells me to jump through a hoop, I'm probably not going to like them. And so I have another, it's like I've been, I have another definition of true, of how you tell if something is true. Maybe if you can live with it in place for 12,500 years, that might be something that's true. How's that for a definition of truth? Or how about if something makes the world a better place on its own terms, that's a truth. These are entirely different. They're relational versions of truth, which are really nice, Derek, but what the hell does it have to do with sustainability? So the point is that I'm going to take this out. Okay, so first off, any way of life based on the hyper-exploitation or on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. Any way of life that's based on hyper-exploitation of renewable resources won't last. I'm going to take it a step further, and I'm going to say that any way of life that's based on the use of resources won't last. And the reason I say that is because resources don't exist. What I mean by that is that trees don't consider themselves a timber resource and fish don't consider themselves a fisheries resource. They're just trees and they're just fish. And this is really important because how you perceive the world affects how you behave in the world. How you perceive another affects how you treat them. There's a great line by a Canadian lumberman. When I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. If when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them another way. If when you look at this particular tree, you see this particular tree, you'd treat it differently still. Same is true for salmon. If when I look at salmon, I see dollar bills, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at salmon, I see salmon, I'll treat them another way. If when I look at this particular fish, I see this particular fish, I'll treat it differently still. Same is true for women. If when I look at women, I see orifices, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at women, I see women, I'll treat them another way. If when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, I'll treat her differently still. And that, by the way, does not, just because I, when I look at this particular fish, I see this particular fish, doesn't mean, by the way, that I can't eat it. I gotta tell you, one reason I love doing talks again and again, as opposed to making a brand new one up for, like I did in Michigan, which I only used once, one reason I love doing talks again and again is because it takes me a long time to actually develop a talk that really works. And I try out all sorts of jokes, and they work or don't work. I try all sorts of stuff. And a joke that I tried that didn't work is, it always bothered me that I went trees, fish, women, and then back to fish. When I, you know, just because when I look at a fish, I doesn't mean I can't eat, and see a fish, it doesn't mean I can't eat it. So one night I went trees, fish, women, and then I said, just because when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, doesn't mean that I can't eat her. The person who brought me to do that talk was this woman in her early 60s who was standing in the back, and she was doing her very best Queen Victoria impression. She's like, we are not amused. So I dropped that one. Anyway, so one night I was doing a talk, or no, I was doing an interview one day in Spokane, Washington, and the guy doing the interview said, you know, Indians exploited salmon too. I said, no, they didn't. They ate them. He said, well, what's the difference? I said, well, they gave him respect for the spirit in exchange for the flesh. I knew that answer was kind of bullshit, but I'm a male, and so I'm required by law to answer every question that's asked of me. And that afternoon, I went out and I sat next to the tree I had a long relationship with, and I asked the tree, what is the fundamental predator-prey relationship? And the tree gave me the answer right away, which is, if you consume the flesh of another, you take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. If you consume the flesh of another, you take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. Not in terms of stewardship, which comes from the root stiward, which means in charge of the pigsty, but instead in terms of responsibility, which comes from the root, which means to give in return. And everybody knows this. Everybody knows that if you, I mean, bears know this, mergansers know it, newts know it. Mergansers know that if you eat all the newts in a pond, there's not going to be any food for you anymore. Everybody knows that the way to survive is to give in return. And so if I consume the flesh of salmon from the Klamath River, I now take responsibility for the continuation of the Klamath River salmon community. That's how you survive. And that's all really nice, Derek, and this is all really fun, but what does it have to do with something being sustainable or with civilization? And, you know, when I wrote Endgame, I'd been bashing civilization for years, and I thought I probably better finally define it. And so civilization I have defined as a way of life characterized by the growth of cities. That's nice, Derek. And this is defensible both linguistically and historically. That's nice, Derek, but what's a city? So a city I've defined as people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. And this means a few things. Well, first off, the Talawa were not civilized. They did not live in cities. They lived in villages, camps. They did not, but what I mean by this is they didn't require the importation of resources. They lived with what the land gave willingly. They would eat salmon, elk, shellfish, marine mammals, smelt, salmon, huckleberries, salmon, and then usually all through the winter they'd eat a lot of salmon. And they did so not taking more than what the land could give. And, you know, it's like Ray Rafael talks about this, that you know, some people say, well, you know, Indians, they affected the land base too, and since they affected the land base, in fact, Charles Mann says this, which is another thing you can fuck off too. Charles Mann says that because Indians affected their land base, then that means that, quote, anything goes. And no, actually. One of the big differences is that indigenous humans, and I think non-humans too, oftentimes make land use decisions based on the fact that they're planning on living there for the next 500 years. And if you're planning on living in place for the next 500 years, you're going to make different land use decisions than if you're not. I mean, you're not going to frack. You're not going to kill the Great Lakes. You're not going to do any of that. So anyway, the point is that two things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One of them is that as soon as you require the importation of resources, it means your way of life can never be sustainable. Because if you require the importation of resources, it means that you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource. I know a dirty word, resource, but oh well. Anyway, so, and as your city grows, you'll denude an ever larger area. You know, once again, it's embarrassing to have to talk about the fact that a city requires colonies. The other thing it means is that your way of life must be based on violence. And the reason is because if you require the importation of resources, trade will never be sufficiently reliable. Because if you require the importation of resources and the people in the next watershed over will not trade you for this resource, you're going to take it because you require it. I'm not talking about trading shells for buffalo robes because those weren't required. That's optional. But if you need it and they won't trade you, you'll take it, which means we could all become junior bodhisattvas and the U.S. military would still have to be huge. Because how else are they going to get access to the oil they need to run the economy that just happens to be under somebody else's land? And so the point is that we could all have this magical, spiritual, wonderful transformation. It doesn't fucking matter because the problems are institutional, functional, systemic. Okay, so that, by the way, is the first premise right here. So you brought sleeping bags, right? Okay, premise two. Traditional communities do not often voluntarily give up or sell the resources on which their communities are based until their communities have been destroyed. They also do not willingly allow their land bases to be damaged so that other resources, gold, oil, and so on, can be extracted. It follows that those who want the resources will do what they can to destroy traditional communities. That's something we've seen once or twice on this continent. Premise three. Our way of living, industrial civilization, is based on, requires, and will collapse very quickly without persistent and widespread violence. Our way of living, industrial civilization, is based on, requires, and will collapse very quickly without persistent and widespread violence. Now, I was doing a talk in Eugene, Oregon several years ago, and after the talk, there was this guy who said to me, you know, you talk about this culture being based on violence, but I just don't see it. Don't see it at all. I don't see any violence. I have no violence in my life. And I don't allow violence in my life. In fact, I have such little violence in my life that I don't allow anybody to use any words to start with V-I-O. Nobody gets to say violin, viola, anything, nothing. And violet, he didn't like the color violet. Anyway, it's first off, it's significant that a guy said this and not a woman. Because the gold standard studies are that one out of every four women are raped in their lifetime. Another 19% fend off rape attempts. And most of the women I know say that those figures are really low. And so it's much easier for a guy to say, God, I don't see any violence than it is for a woman. Second, I said to him, great, so you don't have any violence in your life. Where's your shirt made? And he looked, and his shirt's made in Bangladesh. I was like, okay, do we even need to talk about sweatshops? He's like, free trade. And then I said, okay, let's try again. Do you pay rent? And he said, yeah. And I said, why? He said, because I don't own. And I said, no. Why do you pay rent? What would happen if you didn't? He said, well, I'd get evicted. And I said, I don't know what that means. What does eviction look like? What would happen? He said, well, a sheriff would come to my house. And I said, stop right there. So a sheriff comes to your house. It's just dinner time. So you say, hey, it's dinner time. Come on in. And you feed him like a 7-course meal of donuts or something. And then after dinner, you say, you know, your company's been kind of pleasant, but not really all that pleasant. And so this is my home, and I'd like for you to leave now. He said, well, he'd pull out his gun, and he'd say, you didn't pay your rent, so I'm kicking you out of your home. I said, so you're telling me the reason you pay rent is because if you don't, some guy with a gun's going to come and kick you out of your home. He said, I don't get it. I said, okay, let's try this again. Let's say you're really hungry. You go to the grocery store. You just start eating. There's lots of food there, you know? I said, what's going to happen? He said, well, they're going to call the sheriff, and he's going to come with his gun. I said, yeah, same guy. He's a real asshole, isn't he? He's going to come and kick you away. So I said, okay, so what you're telling me is the reason you pay rent and the reason you pay for food is because if you don't, some guy with a gun's going to come and do something bad to you. So one of the reasons that we don't perceive a lot of the violence in our lives is because we're so fully metabolized into the system that we don't see how crazy it is that we have to pay in order to sleep and we have to pay in order to eat. And when we pay somebody to eat, we're not paying Farmer Joan or Farmer Fred. We're paying. Are there any food activists in the room? Oh, good. I can make up whatever statistics I want then. It's like 90% of all, like four companies control 90% of the grain market, and four companies control 90% of the beef market. One company controls 175% of the endomami bean market. You know, I don't think, of the okra market. They can fucking have it. Oh, God, I've got an okra-loving crowd here. Anyway, so you're not paying Farmer Joan. You're paying Monsanto. You know, you're paying ConAgra. You're paying ADM. And one of the reasons we don't perceive a lot of the violence is because we're so fully metabolizing the system, we don't notice it. We just accept it as the way you're supposed to live. And another reason we don't notice a lot of the violence is because a lot of it's simply exported. Who was it who said, was it Chris Hedges? It was either Chris Hedges or Lear Keith or somebody, I don't remember who, said that one of the reasons that we don't see a lot of the violence is because we're all living in a giant gated community and the guards are the U.S. military. And so the violence is all export. I mean, how do you think that the oil comes here? How do you think that, I mean, you know all this stuff. Okay, so that's premise three, is that we're surrounded by violence and that this system requires violence. Premise four, this is my favorite one of the book. Okay, this culture is based on a clearly defined and widely accepted, yet often unarticulated hierarchy. Violence done by those higher in the hierarchy to those lower is nearly always invisible, unnoticed. When it is noticed, it's fully rationalized. Violence done by those lower on the hierarchy is unthinkable. Done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher in the hierarchy is unthinkable. And when it does happen, it's met with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims. And there's so many examples of this. This is just everywhere. One example would be one example is my own family. You know, my father's extremely violent. He broke my sister's arm. My brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. He raped my mother, my sister, and me. And the one time my brother fought back, he was beaten far worse than he ever was otherwise because he committed blasphemy, sent violence up the hierarchy. That's one example. That's another example. Cops. You know, every time that a cop dies, there's a big state funeral, you know, with the bumper sticker, some gave all gave some. Does anybody know what is the most dangerous civil service profession? Garbage collection. Because you're hanging out with these big fucking trucks that want to kill you. It's big trucks. That's why. When was the last time you saw a state funeral for a garbage collector with a funeral, you know, with a bumper sticker, some gave all gave some? You know, it's not going to happen. And also, every day in the United States, between 4 and 6 people die because they encounter police. So, but we never hear about those because that's violence flowing down the hierarchy. It's like a couple years ago, there was a cop killed an African-American person who was sitting asleep in a car, and it's like the newspaper knew how to handle that. It's like, you know, it's just violence flowing down the hierarchy. No big deal. Except then they also, he was an Iraq war veteran. So then they moved him back up the hierarchy, and the paper didn't know what to do with it. They just were going crazy. And, you know, it seems like you believe me on this one, but if you don't believe me that violence only flows down the hierarchy in that sense, we'll just do a little thought experiment here, which is next time there's some sort of anti-war protest or anti-globalization protest or something like that, just do a little thought experiment. Take a baseball bat. Go up to a cop and say, excuse me, officer friendly, nothing personal, but I'm doing an experiment, and then hit him. And hit him a couple more times real fast. And then I'll talk to you in about 60 years. I was like, there was this case in Oklahoma where a man beat a woman he beat his wife to death, and for that he was sentenced to 7 years in prison. And when he was going through the judicial process, he spat on a cop. Yep.
No.
And for that, he was sentenced to life in prison.
Wow. This court is worse.
Well, yeah. See, he understands.
He's assaulted a superior.
Exactly. That's exactly. And this is the natural order of things. You know, it's like man, woman, cop. Isn't that the way? This is what we in the United States call irony. I want to. Yeah, so let's see. What's another example? Bears. The bears have just come out of hibernation where I live. Are there bears around here? There's bears all over the place. My mom sees bears constantly. I see bears every day. I see bears. My mom was complaining to me yesterday because the bears were sitting outside her house and she couldn't let her dogs out, so the dogs pooped in the house. And, I mean, so we see bears often enough that it's like, you know, fucking bears, you know? And I walk through the forest at night all by myself, all the time with no flashlight, and people are like, oh my God, there's bears there, aren't you afraid? Well, what I know is that there's one person dies in North America every 2 years because of a bear attack, and there are 45,000 people die every year in the United States from automobile accidents. So the truth is that you should walk through a forest just da-da-da-da-da-da. You walk through a parking lot, it's like, oh my God, you know? And the car's like, we're going to get you. What's another one? Another example. Violence only flows down the hierarchy. Another example of this is the movie Jaws, you know? Mm-hmm. I live 3 miles from the ocean, and you know how often I get in? Never. You know why? That fucking movie. I saw it when I was 16. The acting's actually pretty good in it. And I tell you, I get within about a quarter mile of the ocean, I start hearing that theme music. But what I know is the ratio of human attacks on sharks to shark attacks on humans is literally 20 million to one. So the truth is that when sharks are swimming around, they see a human, it's like they hear the theme music. What's another example? Another example of the violence only flowing one direction is 9/11. Am I the only person in the room who is really sick of hearing about 9/11? That was violence flowing down the hierarchy. What, 3,000 people died that day? There are 15,000 Americans die every 2 weeks from preventable cancers. But they don't count, because it's not violence flowing down the hierarchy. There are about 500,000 people die around the world every year as a direct result of pollution. But that doesn't count. I read that there are 60,000 Americans die every year because of unsafe working... No, 6,000. 60,000 Americans die every year from unsafe working conditions. 600,000. 6 million. Every American dies every year from unsafe working condition. One more example of violence only flowing down the hierarchy is does anybody mind if I swear? I think the word fuck is the most amazing word in the English language because it's all of patriarchy condensed into four letters. Because the same word that means make love to means do great violence to. That's really, really messed up. It's also really confusing because somebody can say to me, I'm going to fuck you. I'm like, I need more information. Okay, it's really, really messed up that sex and violence are conflated in the first place. That's really, really disturbing. And it's also, once again, the core of patriarchy. And then it's also, it finally helped me understand homophobia, which is something that I had never understood before at all. Because it always seemed pretty clear to me that if you don't like homosexuals, you probably just shouldn't date one. You know, it's a pretty easy solution. But I finally understood it because of this great line by Catherine McKinnon. Man fucks woman, subject, verb, object. Man fucks woman, subject, verb, object. The objectification of women in this culture is so deeply held in our psyches that even within the context of a loving heterosexual relationship, it's almost impossible to not objectify the woman. So the man says to the woman, I would like to be inside of you. She's the object of the sentence. So the woman says to the man, I would like for you to be inside of me. She's still the object of the sentence. So the object of the fucking sentence, actually. And then the man says, the man's going to be all groovy and pro-feminist. So he says, I would like for you to be around me. And she says, you know, the body is willing and the mind has no idea what you're talking about. Can you please speak English? So the way this relates to homophobia is about God. A long time ago now, maybe 12, 13 years, once again, I didn't understand homophobia at all. And then I was watching, and I was listening to NPR. I'm so sorry. We all have things we do that we regret later in life. Anyway, I was listening to NPR, and I heard this military spokesman, man, talking about at the time why homosexuals should not be allowed into the military. And by the way, I have to say, full disclosure here, I have to say I actually agree that homosexuals should not be allowed in the U.S. military. I feel that very strongly. But then again, I also think that heterosexuals, bisexuals, asexual people should also. But have you ever thought, wouldn't it be kind of cool if, like, they each had their own army? You know, it's like the bisexual brigade to the rescue or something. Anyway, the military spokesman was saying that the reason that there should not be homosexuals in the military is because he said, can you imagine what would happen if a private had sex with a lieutenant? And I was thinking, sure, I can imagine that, but that really wasn't his point. He said it would destroy chain of command. And it wouldn't destroy chain of command because the lieutenant would fall in love with the private and not be able to order the private to his death. But instead, the point is that he said if a private has sex with a lieutenant, he did not say if a lieutenant has sex with a private. See, he was talking about sex going up the hierarchy. If a private has sex with a lieutenant, that's the thing, is within, when you have, when violence can only flow down the hierarchy, as is true in this culture, and when sex is conflated with violence, as is true for patriarchy, what that means is sex can only flow down the hierarchy. It means you have to have a fucker and a fuckee. And that's where homophobia comes in, because if you have the fucker and the fuckee on the same level, all the little tiny brains seize up. And so I think I'm kind of beating that idea to death. So if I'm beating an idea to death, is that... Okay, so premise five. Premise five is the property of those higher on the hierarchy is more valuable than the lives of those below. It is acceptable for those above to increase the amount of property they control in everyday language to make money by destroying or taking the lives of those below. This is called production. If those below damage the property of those above may kill or otherwise destroy the lives of those below. This is called justice. I kind of like that line. Sixth premise. This culture is not redeemable. The culture will not undergo any sort of voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living. If we don't put a halt to it, this culture, civilization, will continue to immiserate the vast majority of humans and to degrade the planet until it, civilization, probably the planet, collapses. The effects of this degradation will continue to harm humans and non-humans for a very long time. I want to be clear that every cell in my body wants for us to have a voluntary transformation. Don't believe it's going to happen. And I'm not going to bet the world on something that I know is not going to happen. I'm not going to bet the world on magical thinking. It's like a friend of mine says, a doctor friend, he says the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. And wouldn't it be great if you go to the doctor and they say, you know, you actually don't have cancer and you actually don't have all these other things, because if we actually talk about the condition that we have, you actually have to do something. So instead, what we'll do is we'll say things are going fine, you're living perfectly sustainable, smoking 15 packs of cigarettes a day, and everything's cool, everything's groovy, don't change a thing. Anyway, and the next thing is that, you know, I'm going to talk a little bit later about fighting back, and I want to be really clear that when I talk about fighting back, what I mean, that fighting back can mean capital F fighting back, as in picking up weapons, and it can also mean many, many, many other things. And one of my heroes is Sharon Duggan, who is an attorney in California who has argued before the state Supreme Court against – she has protected more forest land than anybody else I know in California. And she recognizes the system is entirely fucked. It's entirely set up to protect property. It's entirely set up to maximize production. But she does what she can. I don't believe in the reform versus revolution dichotomy. If we all wait for the glorious revolution, there's not going to be anything left. And if all we do is reform work, it's going to grind away until there's nothing left. We need it all. I sometimes get accused of being the violence guy. I don't like that at all, because I'm not the violence guy. I'm the everything guy. We need everything, and I fully believe that. And where I first learned this, really, was when I taught at Pelican Bay State Prison, which is a supermax prison in Northern California. I was fully aware every time I walked into that prison that I was participating in the biggest racist gulag on the planet. At the same time, a lot of my students were telling me, I was a Nazi doctor, you know? I was walking in making life marginally better for people whose lives are shit. And at the same time, I was fully aware that a lot of my students were telling me that the only things that were keeping them sane were our classes. So I'm not a purist. I don't give a shit about purity. I don't give a shit about purity at all. I give a shit about there being more salmon in the air every year than the year before. And I don't care how it happens. I don't care if the dams come down in the Klamath because of an agreement between Warren Buffett, Pacific Gas and Electric, or Pacific Power and the states of California and Oregon, or if they come down because somebody takes some explosives. I don't care. I don't think the salmon care either, actually. And we'll get to that in a second. Premise 7. The longer we wait for civilization to crash, or the longer we wait before we ourselves bring it down, the messier will be the crash, and the worse things will be for those humans and non-humans who live during it, and for those who come after. You know, if somebody would have brought down civilization 200 years ago, if Tecumseh would have won, then people in this area could still be able to eat passenger pigeons, even ignoring passenger pigeons' wonderful right and existence of their own. And if somebody would have brought it down 100 years ago, people could still eat salmon in the Pacific Northwest. There would still be enough for everybody to eat salmon. You know, our people, 50 years from now, people are going to be sitting along the banks of the Columbia River. They'll be glowing, for one thing, because of Hanford. And they will be saying, I'm starving to death because you didn't remove the dams on the Klamath River, or on the Columbia River. God damn you. You know, it's like 50 years from now, people are going to be saying there used to be migratory songbirds, there used to be fish in the oceans. You know, the longer we wait, the worse things are going to be. And the only measure by which we'll be judged by the people who come after is the health of the land base. They're not going to give a shit as to whether we voted Democrat, Republican, Green, we didn't vote at all. They're not going to give a shit about whether we were nice people. They're not going to give a shit about whether we were violent or nonviolent. They're not going to give a shit about whether we recycled. What they're going to care about is whether they can breathe the air and drink the water. You know, we can all fantasize about some groovy eco-socialist utopia with free love for everybody. And I do fantasize about that. We can fantasize about some groovy eco-socialist utopia. And if you can't breathe the air, it doesn't matter. That's the thing that we keep forgetting, is the real world is real. The real world's primary. You know, and I mentioned this earlier, but I'll say it again, that it just drives me crazy. But even somebody as smart as Peter Montague, who has done the Rachel, he's quit now, he's retired, but he did the Rachel's newsletter on toxics for years. Brilliant newsletter, wonderful. Even somebody as smart as him still doesn't get it, in that he would say that, he was talking about carbon sequestration and why it's a bad idea, and he said it's a bad idea because if all the carbon leaked out at once, it could, quote, disrupt civilization as we know it. It's like, no, Peter, it could end life on Earth. And it's the same with Bill McKibben. You know, Bill McKibben has done great work raising awareness about global warming. He's mobilized a lot of people. He's done great work. But when you ask, when he's asked and when he talks about this, he says explicitly he is doing this to save civilization. He doesn't say he's doing this to save the oceans. He doesn't do that. He's not doing this to save the monarch butterflies, the migratory songbirds, the bats. And this is all insane. Once again, literally insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality, because the real world is real. Once again, embarrassing to have to say, the real world is primary. Okay, the next premise is the needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. I've just guaranteed I will never hold public office. Another way to put the eighth premise is, any economic or social system that doesn't benefit the natural communities on which it's based is unsustainable, immoral, and really stupid. Sustainability, morality, and intelligence, as well as justice, requires the dismantling of any such economic or social system, or at the very least disallowing it from damaging your land base. Okay, so let's move to premise 9. Before we talk about premise 9, I want to talk for a second about the fact that there are a few things I can't talk about. There are many things I can bash and a few things I can't. I can bash capitalism. Nobody cares. I can bash Christianity. Nobody cares. I can bash environmentalism. Nobody cares. I can bash anarchism. Well, anarchists care. And I can bash anarchists who bash environmentalists. I can bash environmentalists who bash anarchists. I can bash blah, blah, blah. Nobody cares about any of that shit. But three things I can't talk about. One of them is I can't bash science. Because if I start to bash science, I can just feel the sphincters in the audience start to quiver. And, you know, science is a much better means of social control than Christianity ever was. Because if you don't believe in Christianity, then you're consigned to a hell you don't believe in. And if you don't believe in science, you must be just plain stupid, which is far more scary. The other thing I can't do is I can't bash Buddhism. You cannot say you've lived until you've been chased down the street by a bunch of angry pacifists. And the third thing that I can't do is I can't talk about the fact that there are too many people on the planet. Because as soon as you talk about the fact that there are more people on the planet than the planet can support, then everybody says, you must not like babies. Well, the truth is I don't really like babies. Except with this really good barbecue sauce out of Kansas City. Awesome. That's a joke. I got to tell you, I told that joke in Hamilton, Ontario, and the whole place burst into applause. I said, I don't understand. And the guy said, it's a Hamilton thing, man. And I said, I don't want to know anything more about this at all. Okay, but that said, there are more humans on the planet than the planet can support. Humans have exceeded carrying capacity. Carrying capacity is the number of any given species who can live in a place forever, more or less forever, without harming the place. And so, for example, you can have an island with a carrying capacity of 1,000 deer, and 1,000 deer could live there forever. You can have more than 1,000 deer there, but they're going to permanently reduce the carrying. They're going to overshoot and permanently reduce the carrying capacity. So, for example, you have this carrying, this island with a carrying capacity of 1,000 deer. You could have 5,000 deer on it, and what they'll do is they'll eat too much, shit too much, and scrape away the soil with their hooves too much, and it will reduce the carrying capacity of the island to 100 deer, whatever. Oh, by the way, they always say, you know, one of the cliches that you always hear is there is no such thing as a stupid question. That is so not true. I get them all the time. And one stupid one I'm going to share with you now. There's I was talking about the fact that humans have exceeded carrying capacity, and this guy was so mad he was sputtering. And he said, how dare you say that humans have exceeded their capacity to care? Which may or may not be true, but that's another subject. Anyway, so, okay, but before we go on to premise nine, I want to say that when people talk about population, I think they talk about it very, very poorly in many ways. Because, yes, humans have exceeded carrying capacity, but I don't believe that population is a primary problem. The reason I don't think population is a primary problem is because I think consumption is far more important. Because actual numbers of human beings doesn't really matter. What's important is how much you eat shit and how many resources you consume, how much waste you put out. That's all way more important. And the reason this is important to talk about is because if we talk about when we talk about overpopulation, so often the first image that comes to mind is a little brown baby with a distended belly in a non-industrialized nation. And on the other hand, when we talk about overconsumption, the first thing that comes to mind is a Canadian. Because Canadians use more resources per capita than people in the United States. It's their fault. So the first thing we think about when we think about consumption, I mean, who actually does more harm to the planet? A subsistence farmer with 5 children in India, or a typical person in the United States who consumes like 490 times the resources or whatever? You know, so when people talk about population, and also I'm sure you've noticed this, that the capitalists freak out whenever white people start going down in population. It's like it just kills me. It's like population is a terrible problem, except in Greece where it's going down, and then we have to give incentives, or in Russia where it's going down, so we have to give incentives and give people like 3 years maternity leave and have babies. And don't they do this thing where they give like baby making days?
They did it in France, and they encourage people to have more kids in France.
Yeah, it's like you get a day off from work to make a baby. Yeah. Hey, I got an idea. I don't have a regular job, but if I had a regular job, I could say, yeah, I want baby making days, and I've had a vasectomy, but that's okay. It's like, I'll still try. So population is not a primary problem, and it's a secondary problem because consumption is more important than population. But actually, I think the population is a tertiary problem because I think that what's more important than either population or consumption is a refusal to acknowledge limits that leads to that. This overpopulation did not occur in a vacuum. Are there any demographers in here? Good. I hate demographers. And the reason I hate demographers is because they talk about something called a natural rate of population growth. And what that means is if you have, you know, X number of people, and they're usually little brown dots, if you have X number of people, and then as time goes by, the population goes up and up and up and up and up. And what that presumes is that people breed like rabbits. But I don't even believe that rabbits breed like rabbits. I believe that people make rational planning decisions based upon their personal and social circumstances. I believe rabbits make personal family planning decisions based on personal and social circumstances. I mean, for crying out loud, you know, if you put worms in a worm bin and you limit the amount of food they have, they limit the number of babies they have. And worms don't even have a brain. They do have 5 hearts, though, which means they have a larger capacity to care. Anyway, so picture 2 cultures. One of these cultures has all of its mythologies are cyclical. Everything is about circles. And you also believe that harm to the natural world is harm. And you plan on living in place for 12,500 years. And the other culture is your myths are linear. You believe in progress. And you're not planning on living in place. You're planning on going all over the world. And also, somebody writes a book that tells you that you should go forth and multiply, and this book becomes a really big bestseller. So people in these cultures are going to make different rational family planning decisions. Oh, 2 things about this. One of them is, I just read the other day, we could actually solve overpopulation immediately with one very simple non-authoritarian means, which is I just read not very long ago that more than half of the human children born are unwanted. I don't mean unplanned, I mean unwanted, which means very simple solution to all overpopulation problems, make contraception available to all women freely, give women absolute reproductive freedom. Done deal. We've solved overpopulation. We can all retire. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so let's go watch the March Madness. Here's the deal. Is, I don't know if you know this, but prior to the Europeans arriving here, Native North Americans used up 250 different plants as contraceptives and abortifacients. And it was the women who made the choices to use these. It's a bunch of fucking primitives. I love this story. That there was these about 100 and some years ago, some anthropologists went to see some indigenous peoples, and they were male anthropologists, and they wanted to ask how it was what they used for contraception. And so the male anthropologists, of course, only talked to the men because the men are the only ones worth talking to. And they said, how do you not have babies? And the anthropologists, or the indigenous men responded, it's a secret. And so the anthropologist went back and said, the indigenous people don't know where babies come from. And then like 20 years later, some female anthropologists went out and they went to the same peoples and they asked the women, how is it that you, what do you do for contraception? And the women were like, well, when you're 16, you eat this certain root, and then that'll make you sterile for 5 years. Then when you're 21, if you want to have a baby, you eat this. And if you don't have a baby, you eat that. And the men are like, really? I had no idea. Anyway, so this is a long way of saying, so yes, consumption is more important than population. The mindset behind it all is even more important. But that doesn't alter the fact that there's too many humans for the planet to support. Humans have exceeded carrying capacity. Okay, having said that, okay, now we get to premise 9. Well, we almost get to premise 9. We'll be at premise 9 in just a second, which is that I was doing a talk one time. I did two talks in the same town on the same day. And this one woman hated what I had to say so much that she came to both talks. And she accused me of being a combination of Mao, Pol Pot, and Stalin because I want to bring down civilization. And her logic is that I had the trifecta. And the logic was that because I want to bring down civilization, I want to kill a lot of people. Therefore, I'm like Mao, Pol Pot, and Stalin. And I didn't like her rhetoric. And, you know, I am not nearly as smart as my books make me seem. Because in my books, I have all these conversations with friends where the friend will say something really smart, and I say something really smart back, and then the friend says something really smart. That's not how it happened. What really happened is my friend says something really smart. I say, wow, that's really smart. And then I call them back in like a month. And then they say something really smart right away, and then I call them back in another month. And so that night, I had no idea. It was like, she said, you're a combination of Mao, Pol Pot, and Stalin. And I said, oh, yeah? Well, what are you then? But later I came up with a bunch of answers for her, which I'm now going to inflict on you. And the first answer is that, I mean, her basic point is that bringing down civilization is going to kill a lot of people. And my first answer is that if you participate in the global economy, your hands are blood red. You got blood all over your hands. If you don't participate in the global economy, but you allow it to continue, your hands are blood red. If you bring it down, your hands are blood red. We're in a bad situation, in the middle of an exploitative situation, and doing nothing is not a moral answer. And so you can't get on a moral high horse for someone who wants to stop that situation. That's nice, Derek, but that doesn't alter the fact that bringing down civilization is going to kill a lot of people. So my next answer is that my definition of bringing down civilization is I want to deprive the rich of their ability to steal from the poor, and I want to deprive the powerful of their ability to destroy the planet. Nobody but a capitalist or a sociopath, insofar as there's a difference, could argue with that, which doesn't alter the fact that bringing down civilization is going to kill a lot of people, including me, by the way. I have Crohn's disease, and I'm dependent for my life upon high-tech medicine. So when I talk about bringing down civilization, this is not some abstract thing. I will be dead 6 months maximum. But I also understand that the health of the land base is more important than any human life, including my own. Well, that's nice, Derek, but a lot of people are going to die. So I got another answer, which is bringing down civilization is not a monolithic act. It's a bazillion different acts done by a bazillion different people with a bazillion different moralities. And, I mean, for example, you cannot make, and they all have different moralities, you cannot make a moral case for blowing up a children's hospital. You can't do it. I don't care. Oh, yeah, you can. If you're bringing freedom and democracy to a country, then you can. You can't make a moral case. I don't care if you're an anarcho-primitivist or if you are a capitalist or if you are anything else. Blowing up a children's hospital is an atrocity. I don't care. On the other hand, I don't think you can make an argument against taking out cell phone towers. You cannot make a moral argument against taking out cell phone towers. And and the reason cell phone towers, taking them out, is really important is there's a bunch of reasons. First off, they allow the asshole at the next table to yammer on when you're trying to eat. Have you noticed that? You know, I got to tell you, times have changed because I've been complaining about this for 15 years. And back when I used to complain about it, everybody in the whole audience is like, they'd already grabbed pitchforks. It's like, yeah, I hate it when those fuckers at the next table. And then about 8 years ago, it's like, yeah, it's bad. And by now, it's like, what's your deal, man? Yeah, who gives a shit? Okay, that's one reason. Another reason that cell phone towers are really bad is because they put out those, electromagnetic dealy bobs. And then they go like this. That's the scientific explanation. They go like this, and they get in your head, and then they bounce back and forth, and you got to put on the aluminum beanie, and if you put it on wrong side out, then that doesn't happen to you. Okay, so the third reason they're really bad is because they kill between 5 and 50 million migratory songbirds every year. They're major killers of migratory songbirds. And anyway, you cannot make a moral case against taking out a cell phone tower. That's nice, Derek, but as you bring down civilization, a lot of people are going to die. Well, my next answer is, which people are you talking about? Are you talking about hammerhead shark people? talking about salmon people? You're talking about monarch butterfly people? If you were to ask polar bears if we should bring down civilization, they would say, yeah. And if you ask prairie dogs if we should bring down civilization, they would say, yep. But they don't count right because they're just non-human, so they're not real people, right? Okay, well, fine. Which people are you talking about? Years ago, I interviewed Anuradha Mittal, former director of Food First, and I asked her, would the people of India be better off if the global economy disappeared tomorrow? And she laughed and said, of course, poor people the world over would be better off immediately. Would subsistence farmers in India be better off if they weren't being forced off their land? There are former granaries of India that now export dog food and tulips to Europe. So would those people be better off without... What about the people in Africa whose land is being grabbed by the Chinese right now or by the Europeans? What about the people in Jamaica who are being forced into doing cash crops for export as opposed to subsistence farming? What about the people in the Zinku River who are fighting the Belo Monte Dam? You know, it's like, which people are you talking about? I think we can break people into four basic groups for that. I think around the world, the rural poor all over the world would be better off. The people who don't have electricity right now, what do they care if the grid goes down? The people the world over, the rural poor, would be better off because nobody would be stealing their land. The rural rich would be fine. They've got guns. The urban rich, they're the problem. Fuck them. The urban poor, that's a problem. And part of the reason it's a problem is because we have been all made dependent upon the very system that's exploiting us. So I go back and forth with the urban poor. Would the urban poor be worse off if the whole system came down? On one hand, I think yes, because they're dependent. Like Egypt is dependent upon food, importing lots of food. But on the other hand, if you want to talk about instant land reform, stop immediate military support of all these dictatorships. And which side you, I mean, honestly, if I have a choice between 1,000 poor people with machetes or 50 people with guns that only have 5 bullets apiece, it's like if you stop the flow of weapons to the rich, you're going to get instant land reform. That's all nice, Derek, but it doesn't alter the fact that a lot of people are going to die. And this is also a really important reason. Thing. This whole thing about being dependent upon the system that's exploiting us, one of the reasons that we don't fight back is because if your experience is that your food comes from a grocery store and your water comes from the tap, you will defend to the death the system that brings those to you, even if it's exploitative. If, on the other hand, your food comes from a land base and your water comes from a river, you will defend to the death those because your life depends on it. One of the brilliant things that the culture has done has been to insert itself between us and the source of life. This is intentional. This is what any good abusive system does. Why? There are a lot of abused women who stick around with the abusers because they've got children and they have no source of income. This is my mother in the 1950s and 60s. And this is what a system does. And it's not just abusers. It's also, there was a great line by this southern pro-slavery philosopher in the 1830s. He said, he was talking to his northern abolitionist capitalist buddy, and he said that there are land ownership conditions in which it's in the capitalist's best interest to own slaves, and there are land ownership conditions which is in the capitalist's best interest to not own slaves. Very simple. If you have a lot of land and not many people, then people have access to land, which means they have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they have access to self-sufficiency, which means the only way you can get them to work for you is at the point of a gun. On the other hand, if you have a lot of people and not much land, that means they don't have access to land, which means they don't have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they don't have access to self-sufficiency, which means that they have to go to work for you at whatever pittance you want to pay them. This is intentional. This is why indigenous peoples are consistently dispossessed. This is why the poor are dispossessed, to force them into the economy. How else are you going to get them to work for Monsanto or Apple or whatever else? And there's a great line by Onondaga firekeeper, Orrin Lyons, who says there is no sovereignty without food sovereignty. Food is the basis of everything. It's like years ago, I interviewed a member of the Tupac Amaristas, a rebel group in Peru, the MRTA. And I said, what do you want for the people of Peru? And he said, we want to be able to grow and distribute our own food. We merely need to be allowed to do so. That's the entire struggle right there. That's it. That's everything. And that's all nice, Derek, but a lot of people are going to die. So my next answer is, I guarantee that as civilization collapses, 100% of the misery will be caused by those whose lifestyles are causing this misery, attempting to maintain their lifestyles. The poor are being impoverished because it's like, 70% of famines historically have happened not... The countries that experience famines are generally still net exporters of food. The people in the Irish potato famine, Ireland was exporting grain to England. They're not dying of famine. They're not dying of starvation. They're dying of colonialism. And it's the same with water. We always hear all the time, the world's running out of water. The world's running out of water. Bullshit. The world's not running out of water. Fucking bullshit. Goddamn George Bush, Barack Obama, fucking bullshit. The world's not running out of water. What's happening is the water's being stolen. 90% of the water being used is used for agriculture and industry. People say, oh my God, take shorter showers. You gotta do all this personal stuff to change everything. Take shorter showers, all it's gonna do is ruin your social life. The same amount of water is used by municipal human beings as is used for municipal golf courses. So if you want to save water, you want to take a shorter shower or you want to take out a golf course? I mean, which is more useful? And one of the things they've done is they've convinced us that we are consumers and not citizens and not human animals who need habitat. In the 1980s was the first time that corporate newspapers called human beings consumers more often than citizens. And this is really crucial because if they can get you to identify as a consumer, your choices of resistance are buy or not buy. If, on the other hand, you're a citizen, your choices of resistance are buy, not buy, organize, boycott, when a government becomes destructive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. You can revolt. That's a huge transformation that we should not allow ourselves to buy into. But it goes even further than that, because if you go back a few thousand years, there was another transformation where we went from being human animals who need community and habitat to being citizens of a state. And that transformation involves many things, including one of the classic things in sociology is that if you're a citizen of a state, you grant the state a monopoly on violence. We forget that we are animals who need habitat and whose families are being poisoned, and we forget that we are animals with teeth and claws. And that's all nice, Derek, but this is all really, that's great, wonderful, but a lot of people are going to die. So I have another answer, which is that if you've gotten this far in this talk, or if you're simply anything other than entirely insensate, we probably agree that civilization is going to crash, whether or not we help bring it about. If you don't agree with this, we probably have not much to say to each other. How about them cubbies? We probably also agree that the crash will be messy. We agree further that since industrial civilization is systematically dismantling the ecological infrastructure of the planet, the sooner it comes down, whether or not we help it crash, the more life will remain afterwards to support both humans and non-humans. If you agree with that, and if you don't want to dirty your spirituality and conscience with the physical work of helping to bring down civilization, and if your primary concern really is for the well-being of those humans who will be alive during and immediately after the crash, then given, and I repeat this point to emphasize it, that civilization's going to come down anyway, you need to start preparing people for the crash. Instead of coming to my talks and attacking me for stating the obvious, go rip up asphalt and vacant parking lots to convert them to neighborhood gardens. Go teach people how to identify local edible plants, even the city, especially in the city, so these people won't starve when the proverbial shit hits the fan, they can no longer head off to Albertsons for groceries. Set up committees to eliminate or, if appropriate, channel the additional violence that might break out. Okay, we're going to take a timeout, not a timeout like we're leaving, but a timeout because I want to change the subject for a second. Oh, really? You're going to tell us this time. And that's that. When I talk about this whole thing about channel or eliminate or appropriate channel the additional violence that might break out, there's something else that's really important to talk about, which is I have a friend who says that the reason he does the environmental work he does is because as things become increasingly chaotic, he wants to make sure that some doors remain open. And what he means by that is he wants to protect bull trout or grizzly bears so that because if they're there in 20 years, they may be there in 50. But if they're gone in 20, they're gone forever. So that's why he does his work. But there's another part of this too, which is if you want to know what happens when patriarchal civic society collapses, look at the Democratic Republic of Congo, where rapes are more frequent and they are more organized. And so it is predictable that when social order collapses under patriarchy, it is predictable that men assault women. And instead of pretending that this won't happen, or instead of pretending that there won't be a collapse, we need to prepare for it now. And there are two things that I think this is very important. There are two things I talk about for helping to prevent sexual assault. And one of them is that for women, I always think about the words of Andrea Dworkin. She said, "My prayer for women of the 21st century is harden your hearts and learn to kill." And what that means to me is that the time to learn self-defense is now. The time to learn self-defense is not when someone's breaking down your door. I'm guessing, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm guessing that that some of the veterans may be willing to organize some firearms skill share for women who want to learn self-defense or can point them in the directions where they can learn them. Don't know. Anyway, learn self-defense. And for men, my advice is this. Make your allegiance to women absolute and do it now. Have a zero-tolerance policy for male pattern violence. I have received so many notes from women over the years, female environmentalists, who've said they've been sexually assaulted by male environmentalists. And the typical response in the environmental community is to then call everybody together to have some sort of truth and reconciliation meeting where we all figure out how we can get along. Fuck that. I've gotten a lot of flack from some anarchists because I don't have a problem with calling the cops in circumstances like that. It's like, take care of it in your community if you want to, as long as you fucking take care of it. But if you're not going to take care of it, call the fucking cops. Make them do their job for once, you know? It's like they tell us that they're there to protect us from sociopaths, and let them protect us from a sociopath if they'll actually do it. And if not, in any case, we have to have a zero-tolerance policy, and we have to kick them out of our community at the very least. Emphasis on kick, by the way. So that's, I think, really important is it doesn't matter whether civilization comes down because of peak oil or because of capitalism doing what capitalism does or whether it's because of brave women and men working in alliance with the natural world. As civilization collapses or continues to collapse, men will beat on women. And we need to prepare for that now. And one of the ways to prepare is by having zero-tolerance policy. The same is true, by the way. Anybody thinking about it could have predicted the Tea Party and could have predicted modern racism because as people's entitlement is threatened, they find scapegoats. And scapegoats of people of color, this is a time-honored tradition. And so we as white people, those of us who are white, need to make our allegiance to victims of white supremacist violence absolute as well. Okay, now back to the regular program. We need it all. We need people to take out dams, and we need people to knock out electrical infrastructures. We need people to protest and to chain themselves to trees. We also need people working to ensure that as many people as possible are equipped to deal with the fallout when the collapse comes. We need people working to teach others what wild plants to eat, what plants are natural antibiotics. We need people teaching others how to purify water, how to build shelters. All this can look like supporting traditional local knowledge. It can look like starting gardens. It can look like planting local varieties of medicinal herbs. It can look like teaching people how to sing. Only 2% of the IRA ever picked up weapons. 98% of the people were doing support work. That's absolutely crucial. But 2% did pick up weapons. The truth is, although I do not believe that designing groovy eco-villages will bring down civilization, when the crash comes, I'm sure to be first in line knocking on their doors asking for food. People taking out dams do not have a responsibility to ensure that people in homes previously powered by hydro know how to cook over a fire. They do, however, have a responsibility to support the people doing that work. Similarly, those people growing medicinal plants do not have a responsibility to take out dams. They do, however, have a responsibility at the very least to not condemn those people who've chosen that work. In fact, they have a responsibility to support them. They especially have a responsibility to not report them to the cops. It's the same old story. The good thing about everything being so fucked up is no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. Do what you love, do what you can, do what best serves your land base. We need it all. That doesn't mean that everybody taking out dams and everybody working to cultivate medicinal plants are working toward the same goals. It does mean that if they are, each should see the importance of the other's work. Further, resistance needs to be global. Acts of resistance are more effective when they're large scale and coordinated. The infrastructure is monolithic and centralized, so common tools and techniques can be used to dismantle it in many different places simultaneously if possible. By contrast, the work of renewal must be local. To be truly effective, acts of survival and livelihood need to grow from particular land bases where they'll thrive. People need to enter into conversation with each piece of earth and all its human and non-human inhabitants. That doesn't mean, of course, that we can't share ideas, that one water purification technique won't be useful in many different locations. It does mean that people in those places need to decide for themselves what'll work. Most important of all, the water in each place needs to be asked and allowed to decide for itself. I've been thinking a lot again about the cell phone tower behind Safeway, and I see how these different approaches can manifest in this one small place. The cell phone tower needs to come down. It's contiguous on two sides with abandoned parking lots. Those lots need to come up. Gardens can bloom in their place. We can even do our work side by side. Oh, shit. You know, I skipped over. I did all that preamble to the ninth premise. I never told you the ninth premise. So here's the ninth premise. Sorry. Here's the ninth premise. Although there will clearly be someday be far fewer humans than there are at present, there are many ways this reduction in population could occur. Some of these ways would be characterized by extreme violence and privation. Nuclear Armageddon would certainly reduce population consumption, yet would do so horrifically. The same would be true for a continuation of overshoot followed by crash. Other ways would be characterized by less violence. Blah, blah, blah. Personally and collectively, we may be able to both reduce the amount and soften the character of the violence that occurs during the ongoing, perhaps long-term shift. We may not. But this much is certain. If we don't approach it actively, if we don't talk about our predicament and what we're going to do about it, the violence will almost undoubtedly be far more severe and the privation more extreme. We're fucked. And if we don't talk about it, we're even more fucked. That's ninth premise in short. And I mean, once again, you know, every cell in my body wants for us to have a voluntary transformation. You know, if I ran for president, I would run on a platform of vasectomies on the house. And I even have a campaign slogan. It's a snip in every sack. Anyway, but I don't believe it's going to happen. Okay, so what we have now for the rest of the talk is going to be I have one, two... two more premises, I think, and then I want to bash pacifism, and then I want to bash hope, and then read two short things, and then we're done. Okay, so the 10th premise of the book is the culture as a whole and most of its members are insane. I don't have to talk about that, do I? The culture is driven by a death urge, an urge to destroy life. You know, I've been thinking a lot lately about something I saw at the Academy Awards. You know, those of you who've heard the Endgame talk know that I have kind of a soft spot in my heart for Angelina Jolie. And I was just so, I mean, stunned is the word. You know, when she was standing up there to give out an Oscar and then she put her leg like that and opened up her skirt so you could see the lower thigh. It was just, my heart melted. You know, it melted with joy, really, because I'm so happy that she seems so happy with Brad, even though she's really skinny, you know? It's like, I worry about her because she's so thin. But I think she and Brad, they're a good couple. So what's the name, what's the indigenous name for this place? Where we are right now? So the Potawatomi used to live here. So we have, actually, how many people knew that the Potawatomi? So maybe a third of you? It is insane that I can say the words Angelina Jolie and most of you have at least some idea who I'm talking about, yet a lot of us don't know what the indigenous name for this place is, and we don't know whose land it is. And I'm not attacking anybody here. I mean, it was several years of me living where I live before I learned that there was a massacre of about 250 Indians a few miles from where I live at a place called Yontaket, which is also the center of the universe for the Talawa people. That's the source of creation. And there was another massacre at a place called Achalet, another massacre at a place called Hawanket. And those are all within 5 miles, 8 miles of where I live. And one of the reasons we don't defend the places we live is because we don't live there. We live with, I wonder how Johan Santana is going to do this year. I hope he's able to come back, pitcher for the Mets. This is not a sports crowd. We live, you know, far away. You know, I think it's crazy that I know who Angelina Jolie is and that I can name, you know, half of the starting lineup for the Seattle Mariners. And what's even more insane is that Sean Figgins is one of the starting lineup for him. My God, he hit like 170 last year. Jesus Christ. Note to self, stop making sports jokes. Anyway, I think it's insane that I know all those things, but I can't name 10 species of edible plants and fungi within 100 yards of my home. That's absolutely crazy. Let's see. There's salal, huckleberry, salmonberry, thimbleberry, chanterelle, blackberry. Oh, and there's also those big red mushrooms with the white dots. What? Yeah, I was thinking that if I ate one of those, I could probably take out a dam all by myself. If I ate one of those, I could take out a dam with one finger. So that's part of the problem is that we're crazy in terms of being out of touch with physical reality. And like I was saying earlier about global warming, you know, that so many of the solutions presented take capitalism as a given as opposed to the real world. And, you know, I did a talk several years ago at Bioneers. I'm sorry. And Bioneers is like a gathering of a bunch of people who are, I would say, pathologically optimistic. And they come up with all sorts of sort of groovy solutions where like making forks out of cornstarch instead of plastic. And, you know, oh my God. Their tagline for, I think, last year was the shift is hitting the fan. And anyway, I was there several years ago, and it broke my heart because I was the only person there talking about either power or sociopathology. And I don't understand how you can talk about social change without talking about power. And I don't understand how you can talk about the murder of the planet without talking about sociopathology. You can't do it. This culture is crazy. Okay, 13, 12, 11th premise is we should acknowledge that this culture, from the beginning, this culture has been a culture of occupation. And the government is a government of occupation. And, of course, all of my American Indian friends say, what the hell took you so long to figure this one out? What does a government of occupation do? It moves in, it facilitates resource extraction and maximizes production. That's the function of a government of occupation. And it doesn't care about communities. What does the United States government do in the United States and elsewhere? It moves in and facilitates resource extraction and maximizes production at the expense of communities. I saw this great bumper sticker quite a while ago that said, U.S. out of North America. And so to think about, I want to read just a little page and a half thing about government of occupation, which is, and I think it's really important for us. So many indigenous people have said to me that the first important, most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And part of that has to do with separating ourselves from them, to recognize that there is an enemy. And, you know, so often, you know, we can talk about how, you know, we talk about the government in terms of we or our government. But the first thing we have to do is to separate ourselves and recognize it's not our government. It's their government. If it were a democracy, it would be our government, but it's not. And it's like this friend of mine called me up and said, so much longer do you think we're going to be in Afghanistan? I was like, we're in Afghanistan? I thought we were in Northern California. My friend said, how much longer do you think we're going to have troops in Afghanistan? I said, I got troops? Holy shit, will they do what I tell them? If I tell them to take out the Grand Coulee, will they do it? She said, yeah, this is why I only call you once every 6 weeks. Or my mom, just not very long ago, my mom said, it's just so terrible. It breaks my heart that we torture. I said, Mom, you torture? Oh, my God, that's terrible. And my mom said, you're my son. I'm too old for this. Cut it out. Anyway, if Nazis or other fascists took over North America, what would we all do? We'd watch television, by gum. What would we do if they implemented Mussolini's definition of fascism? Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it's a merger of state and corporate power. And what would we do if they instituted laws allowing them to put a significant portion, say one-third, of all Jewish males in the ages of 18 and 35 into concentration camps? What if this occupied country called itself a democracy, but most everyone understood elections to be shams, with citizens allowed to choose between different wings of the same fascist party? You know, it's like when I was a teenager, I was a little right-wing fanatic when I was a teenager. When I was 19, this is the most embarrassing thing I did in my life. When I was 19, I voted for Ronald Reagan. If he would have won by one vote, I would have killed myself. Anyway, when I was a teenager, I used to think it was so fun to laugh at the Soviet Union because, ha, 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 their Politburo is made up of 99% Communist Party members. Ha, 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 they call themselves a democracy, but ha, it's like, okay, what percent of the Senate and House of Representatives are members of the Capitalist Party? Ha, ha, ha. Anyway, what if anti-government activity was opposed by stormtroopers and secret police? Would you fight back? If there already existed a resistance movement, would you join it? Substitute the word African-American for Jewish and ask yourself the same questions. Between about 35%, one-third of all African-American males between the ages of 18 and 35 are under so-called criminal justice supervision. Some communities like Baltimore, it's over 50%. Anyway, would you resist if the fascists irradiated the countryside, poisoned food supplies, and made rivers unfit for swimming and so filthy you wouldn't even dream of drinking from them anymore? What if they did this because... Hell, I can't finish the sentence because no matter how I try, I can't come up with a motivation good enough even for fascists to irradiate and toxify the landscape and water supplies. If fascists systematically deforested the continent, would you join an underground army of resistance, head to the forests, and from there to boardrooms and the halls of the Reichstag to pick off the occupying deforesters, most especially those who give them the marching orders? Okay. So maybe your sense of kin, your sense of skin, doesn't extend to the natural world. Maybe you don't yet love the land where you live enough that you'd fight for it. But what if the fascists toxify not only the landscape but the bodies of those you love? What if their actions put dioxin and dozens of other carcinogens in the flesh of your mother, lover, children, mother, brother, sister, father? Would you fight back? What if the fascists toxify your own body? You know, what if aliens came down from outer space and they were systematically deforesting the planet and they were vacuuming the oceans, putting dioxin in every mother's breast milk, and they were changing the climate? What would we do? If they were space aliens who were doing all this, I mean, I don't know about you, but I'd grab my camo outfit, grab my AK-47, head off to the wrong audience again. So am I the only person here with an AK-47? You have an AK-47? That's cool. What?
This is Northwest Indiana. We all got guns.
That's great. You know, I was sharing the stage with Ward Churchill one time, and I said, I said that question, am I the only person here with an AK-47? Whole audience is silent, and then I hear this one voice go, nope. and then I did a talk in Western Pennsylvania where I asked the same question. I said, am I the only person here with an AK-47? Like half the audience raised their hands. And they, some two people in the audience got in this big argument over whether, what is it, AK-47s are, what, SK? What's the?
There's a Russian made or
there's a Chinese made. Yeah, so is SK the other one?
SKS.
SKS, yeah. So the two people in the audience got in this argument. They just interrupted my talk, and they just, it's like, I just sat, I mean, the guy, like, fucking got an AK-47. I'm not going to argue with them. It's like, so I just sat back. Well, they argued whether AK-47 or SKS is better. And it's like, I don't really know what this means in terms of whether I actually want to be in Pennsylvania when it all comes down or whether I don't. You know, it's... Anyway, so the point is that what if the fascists or the space aliens or whomever toxified your own body? Would you still cling to the illusion that their edicts carry more weight than that brought to bear by their secret and not-so-secret police? Would you work for this regime? Would you teach others its virtues, or would you fight back? If you won't fight back when they toxify your own body, when precisely will you fight back? Give me, and more importantly yourself, a specific threshold at which you finally take a stand. If you can or won't give the threshold, why not? None of these questions are rhetorical. The questions are real. They are, at this point, some of the most important questions there are. So I think... So I have something I want to say to everyone in this room who is less than 45, which is cherish your memory. Because when you hit 45, it goes straight to hell. I've done this talk so many times before, and it's like after government occupation comes, what does it mean to fight back, culture of resistance, Olympia. What the hell? Why would I talk about Olympia? It's a town in Washington. So, Olympia. Hell if I know. about 45, you get this pretty terrible disease. It's called CRS. It's a CRS syndrome. And it means can't remember shit. It's like, I have this friend, I was complaining about my memory to this one friend of mine who then said back to me, it's like, don't even talk to me about it because, I will routinely find myself standing in the middle of the living room holding a can opener in one hand and plastic bag in the other, wondering why I'm standing there. This is your future. Anyway, we will jump forward to somewhere where I actually do know what I'm talking about, which is I want to jump to the last premise I want to talk about is that the 15th premise of the book is that love does not imply pacifism. And one of the reasons that I wrote Endgame is because for years I had done talks about Capital F fighting back. And the response by audience was really predictable, which is a lot of sort of mainstream peace and social justice activists and mainstream environmentalists would, as I'm talking about fighting back, they would put up what I've taken to calling a Gandhi shield. Which is that they would say the names Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and Dalai Lama again and again as fast as they can to keep all evil thoughts at bay. And grassroots environmentalists would do the same thing, except afterwards they would come up to me and they would say, thank you so much for bringing this up. And then other groups had entirely different responses. And these would be a lot of people of color, especially American Indians, a lot of the very poor, gang kids, a lot of radical environmentalists, survivors of domestic violence, dare I say prisoners, vets would look at me as if to say, why don't you tell us something we don't know? Let's go, bro. And it took me a little while to figure out why there was a difference in that response. And I finally realized that the difference in response is that for the former groups, violence is an abstract spiritual question to be puzzled through. And for the latter groups, it's not. It's something that you have experienced in your own body. And it's not abstract. It's not spiritual. It's not theoretical. Sure, it's spiritual, as everything is spiritual. But it's not theoretical. And it's something you deal with. Doesn't mean you participate, and it doesn't mean you don't. But you don't turn it into something it's not. You don't reify it. You don't turn it into capital V violence. You just deal with it. It's like I was talking to a pacifist one time who said, I got to back up a second and say, my definition of violence is any act that causes harm to another. And I really like this because it shows the ubiquity of violence. This pacifist called me up one time and she was saying, I'm against all forms of violence. I said, my God, how do you defecate? Because every time you defecate, you kill bazillions of bacteria. And she, like Queen Victoria, was also not amused. And so what I'm really interested in is what forms of violence we personally and socially find acceptable or not acceptable. Clearly, socially, we, as a culture, find murdering the planet acceptable. And one of the ways I put this is I say, okay, most of us under most circumstances would find it acceptable to do an act of violence to a carrot. And a carrot has a life that's just as valuable to it as yours is to you and mine is to me. Most of us under most circumstances would find it acceptable to do an act of violence to a carrot. Most of us under most circumstances would not find it acceptable to do an act of violence to a human being. And so I'm really interested in where we draw those lines, personally and socially. And I said this to a pacifist one time. It was so horrible. I was doing this interview with a pacifist. God help me. I do not always make good decisions. Anyway, I gave this pacifist an interview, and I said that to him about the carrot and the human being. And he said to me, so what you're telling me is that there's no difference between a human being and a carrot? I'm like, well, no, actually, it's not what I'm telling you, but thank you for playing. So anyway, when I would talk about fighting back, the audience responses from the pacifists were so stereotypical that what I wanted to do is just write out answers to some of their most common complaints, and then I would write a little pamphlet, and then when they would say, you can't use a master's tool to dismantle the master's house, I would say, here's a pamphlet, go away. And this pamphlet became a 1,000-page book for reasons you can probably understand after having sat here tonight. And so I want to go through a couple of the cliches that they talk about. One of them is that they would say, you know, really the solution to all of our problems is love. And if you just loved enough, you could never talk about fighting back. Because what we really need to do is to love CEOs. Because if we love them, then something good will happen somehow. And if you loved enough, you could never talk about fighting back. I disagree. I think Mother Grizzly Bears will back me up on this one. I think that if you don't defend those you love, then what does love mean? I grew up in the country, and in my life, I have been attacked by mother horses, cows, dogs, cats, chickens, ducks, geese, hawks, eagles, spiders, and mice who thought I was attacking their babies. And if a mother mouse will take on someone 6,000 times her size and win, what the hell's wrong with us? I don't believe that love implies pacifism. So that's one. Another one that they throw out all the time is they say, you know, you talk about us and them, and you talk about an enemy, and don't you realize that if you point a finger at somebody, that actually you have three fingers kind of pointing back at you and one thumb up in the air. And so don't you realize that talking about us and them is really dualistic? And that's just terrible. And so my response to that is, oh, okay, so just to be clear, what you're saying is that dualism is bad and non-dualism is good. Checkmate. Because the truth is that there is a time for dualism and a time for non-dualism. And there's a time to work against and a time to work with. And there is a time to call someone an enemy and a time to not call someone an enemy. And there is a time to reap and a time to sow. And And then also they say, you know, you talk about winning. You know, here's the thing is I enjoy writing, but I'm doing this because I want to win. And they say, but if you talk about winning, then that means somebody has to lose. I got to tell you, right now, hammerhead sharks are losing. Right now, the oceans are losing. And this is, in a sense, a zero-sum game. And frankly, I will be glad when the capitalists lose. And people also say, don't you have compassion for them? I mean, you just have to have compassion. It's like, honestly, it's a bit late in the game to have compassion for perpetrators. And there are enough victims out there and survivors that my compassion is all filled up with them. I have no compassion for perpetrators as perpetrators. As long as a perpetrator is still perpetrating, compassion for them is called codependence. And it's called enabling. Once they stop perpetrating, we can talk about truth and reconciliation or not. We can shoot them in the head. I don't care. But the important thing is to stop the perpetration. Then after that, we can have discussions about compassion. But right now, my compassion is my loyalty. Forget compassion. My loyalty is with the victims. And, okay, well, that's very nice, Derek. But the next thing they say is they go back to the love thing. They say, you know, really, we just need to love more. Because if we all have more love, then everything will be all groovy. And I actually agree with this. I do believe we need to love more. I don't believe we need to love them more. I think we need to love ourselves more. Because if we loved ourselves, we wouldn't put up with any of this shit. If we loved our communities, we would not put up with living in a non-democratic society. If we loved our communities, we would not put up with having water you can light on fire. We would not if we loved our family members, we would not allow them to be poisoned. It's really pretty straightforward. I do believe we should love more. I don't believe we should love them more. You know, I wrote an introduction to a book, I don't remember what it's called. It's by John Lamb Lash. Don't remember what it's called. And it was pretty interesting. He was saying, you know, what is really unique about Jesus' message? And what is unique about Jesus' message is we should turn the other cheek and we should love our enemies. And he made the point that was really good that basically God, you know, the capital G Christian God, I hope I'm not insulting anybody, but I mean, if I haven't insulted you by now, then I guess it's not too late. The capital G God is just a nasty-ass motherfucker, you know? I mean, he's just... I figured out why he's so nasty in the Bible. Because he's lived forever, and he doesn't have a body. And 7 billion years, or however long, is a long time to go without an orgasm. So he just is really pissed off at anybody. I mean, I'd be cranky, too, you know? It's like, I'd be smiting somebody. So God's... It's really interesting because God, the capital G God of the Old Testament, is pretty nasty. And then along what Jesus is basically doing, think about this in terms of an abusive dynamic, with God being the father, being the abusive patriarch, and then Jesus is basically, if we have a woman who is married to someone who is beating the shit out of her and who's doing lots of smiting, and then somebody says to her, what you need to do is you need to love him and you need to turn the other cheek. That's called an ally to the abuser. They make a really nice 1-2 punch, as it were. Okay, the next thing that they always say is they throw out the line, you can't use the master's tools as a man in the master's house. I can't tell you how many times pacifists have said that to me. But I can tell you a couple things. One of them is, and I love Audre Lorde. She's great, so... No complaints with Audre Lorde. Anyway, I can tell you a couple things. One of them is that all the pacifists say that have never read the essay from which it comes. Because the essay from which it comes has nothing to do with pacifism. In fact, the essay from which it comes is about taking a multivariate approach to a problem that's multivariate. That's it. Which is exactly what I'm talking about, taking a multivariate approach to a problem that's multivariate. The second thing I can tell you is, as much as I love Audre Lorde, she never worked construction. Because it is a terrible fucking metaphor. It is the world's worst metaphor. The reason it's the world's worst metaphor is because for a metaphor to work, it has to be true in the real world. And it actually doesn't matter whose tools you use to dismantle the master's house. You know? It's like, you can use my tools, you can use your tools, you can use your Uncle Jed's tools, you can steal tools from Walmart. It doesn't matter. They're just tools. And besides which, that notion, that the idea, not this is not Audre Lorde's fault, this is the pacifist's fault, the idea that those in power own violence, that that's one of their tools, is like, look, they tell us they own the land, they tell us they own the water, they tell us they own genetic materials. I'll be goddamned if I give them violence too. I think that Mother Grizzly Bears will back me up once again. And also, we can't use any of the master's tools? Well, goddammit, okay, spirituality is one of the master's tools because they use, I mean, anybody look at the Christian right, right? It's like, okay, so they use religion. Okay, we can't use religion. They own the media. Well, goddammit, I guess we can't use words either. Let's see, what are the other tools they use? They use guns, so we can't use guns. They use education, so we can't use education. It's just, it's ridiculous. It makes no sense. Okay. The next one that they do is, oh my God, this is so embarrassing. One of the ones they do is they say, okay, how many people in here have my book, A Language Older Than Words? Okay, those of you who have A Language Older Than Words, how many of you have a razor blade at home? Okay, take that chapter called Violence Revisited and cut it out. And since we're all environmentalists, you have to recycle it. You can't throw it away. And the reason is because in that chapter, I say something that is one of the stupidest things that any human being has ever said. I say something that is... it's really embarrassing. I mean, it's like... I mean, I'm talking about it even. It's like talking... It's like admitting to being a compulsive masturbator, which I'm not. Okay, in that chapter... I say that if you fight back, you run the risk of becoming like they are. That is so stupid. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, what does this mean? Does this mean that the woman who kills someone trying to rape her runs the risk of becoming a rapist? I mean, does this mean that Tecumseh ran the risk of becoming like the people trying to steal their land? Does this mean that a tiger who kills a zookeeper runs the risk of becoming a zookeeper? This doesn't make any sense. It's just nonsense. That's the one they throw out. And then, I'll do one more. Which is the other one I throw out all the time, and this one makes me really mad, is I say, you can't ever use violence because violence never accomplishes anything. Really? Seriously, nothing at all. Okay, I did a talk in Galesburg, Illinois last year, and my plane was really late. I flew into Moline, Quad Cities, and I got in maybe midnight, 1 or 2 in the morning, got the shuttle to my hotel. Shuttles, I'm like a mile from the nearest restaurant that's open, which is a Denny's, which was just delicious. And so at 1:30 in the morning, I walk from 2 o'clock, whatever in the morning, I walk from my hotel, which, by the way, touring is not romantic at all. This is like the prototypical tour experience. You know, you get into a hotel 2 o'clock in the morning, walk by myself to a Denny's. Anyway, I'm walking to Denny's, and I go past a McDonald's that is closed, and there is a white van parked in the McDonald's parking lot. As I walk by, it starts up. I'm like, okay, I'm a little bit nervous. Okay, let's think for a second. Okay, first off, women in the room. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. You're in Moline, Illinois, at a hotel. The nearest restaurant is a mile down a highway with no... It's a, let's say, a lonely highway. It's not in town. There's no lights. You're crossing a bridge, which means you can't run away. Okay, are your options are to A, walk to Denny's for the delicious food, or go to bed hungry and wait till the next day. Okay, I am perfectly aware of my male privilege in being able to walk, even though I was kind of nervous. And then you're walking along at 2 o'clock in the morning, nobody's on the highway, and a white van is sitting in the McDonald's parking lot that starts up as you walk by. So as a female... can I presume that your internal thoughts at that point are basically along the lines of or something along those lines? Is that reasonably accurate? Or maybe it's you're thinking the Eric Burden and the Animals song, I gotta get out of this place if it's the last thing I ever do. I mean, so the point is that systematic violence by men against women has systematically changed the behavior of more than 50% of the population. It's been very effective at doing that. So what this means, violence never accomplishes anything, that means that the Indians actually did not have their land stolen. They, by force, instead, they said, hey, we like your way of living a lot better than ours. You want some land? You know, this whole vet thing you're talking about? You know, it's like violence doesn't accomplish anything. I think, wouldn't the Iraqis probably agree that actually violence accomplished nothing whatsoever and it didn't actually change their society or destroy their infrastructure? Or, I mean, it's, you know, I got to tell you that fear of state violence is a significant reason that I have not blown up any dams. It is obscene to say that violence never accomplishes anything. That means there's no global economy. Violence is dreadfully effective. That's why they use it. So a few years ago, I got a call from a friend of mine. She's a longtime activist. She called up. She was crying. She said, you know, this work's killing me. It's breaking my heart. I said, yeah, I know. It'll do that. She said, the dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does. Even itself. She said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does. She said, unless it stops, it's going to kill everything on the planet, didn't it? I said, yeah, it is unless it stopped. I said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? I thought a moment, and I said the thing I knew all along was the best thing I could say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best thing I could say, and the reason I knew that was the best thing I could say, is because maybe, gosh, 15, 16, 17 years ago now, I was undergoing a similar collapse. So I'd been an activist for 6, 7 years at that point. And I couldn't bear it. You know, this was just killing me. I was breaking down into sobs all the time over the death of the salmon, bull trout, Selkirk caribou. And a lot of my activist friends were saying, just take some time off, Derek. You're falling apart. Take some time off. The problems will still be there when you come back. And I knew I couldn't do that. I mean, what's the use of going away to come back to the same old problem? And besides which, if you're not going to cry about the death of the salmon, what are you going to cry about, you know? So I just kept, I was just breaking down all the time. And then one day I called up this friend of mine, Jeanette Armstrong. She's an Okanagan Indian, writer and activist. And I said, this work's killing me. It's breaking my heart. And she said, yeah, it'll do that. I said, the dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does, even itself. I said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does. I said, unless it stops, it's going to kill everything on the planet, didn't it? She said, yeah, it is, unless it stopped. And I said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And she said the best thing she could possibly say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best thing she could possibly say is because it normalized my despair. It let me know that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation. It let me know that the sorrow is just sorrow and the pain is just pain. And it's not so much the sorrow or even the pain that hurts as it is my resistance to it. It let me know that I could feel all those things and it wouldn't kill me. There's this idea that if you really acknowledge how bad things are, you have to go around being miserable all the time. But the truth is, I'm a complex enough being that I can hold in my heart the understanding that we are really fucked. And that life's really, really good. And that we are so fucked. And life's really good. And we're just plain fucked. And that life's really, really good. I am full of rage and hate and sorrow and joy and happiness and contentment and discontent. We're allowed to feel more than one thing at a time, you know? But something even better happened than me realizing I could feel all those things and it wouldn't kill me, which is that I felt all those things and it did kill me. There's a wonderful thing about being dead, which is that once you're dead, they can't touch you anymore. Not through threats, not through promises, not through anything. You can still sing, and you can still dance, and you can still make love, and you can still fight like hell, but they can't touch you. It's a great line by the Zen poet Bunan, die while you're alive and be absolutely dead, then do whatever you want, it's all good. One of the things this has to do with, because what you realize when you die like that is what is the part of you that died is the socially created you. And who's left is the animal you. Who's left is what died is the you that depended upon them. And who's left is the you that's the human animal who needs community and habitat. You know, one of the smartest things that the... I'm going to back up a second. And one of the reasons that my mother stayed with my father was because in the 1950s and 1960s there weren't any battered women's shelters. But another reason she stayed with him is because of the false hope that he would change. And false hopes need to be eradicated. False hopes bind us to unlivable situations. They blind us to real possibilities. False hopes surround us everywhere. Does anybody think that windmills are going to save the day? Does anybody think if we can just get a Democrat in the White House, things will be okay? What are the false hopes that keep you tied to the system? Does anybody think that Weyerhaeuser will stop deforesting because we ask nicely? Does anybody think that Monsanto will stop Monsantoing because we ask nicely? So where does that leave us? But the problem isn't merely false hope. It's hope itself. So I want to talk about something else before I talk about that, which is one of the smartest things that the Nazis did was they made it so that at every step of the way it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. So they would say, do you want to get an ID card? I mean, they would basically make them have the choice. Do you want to get an ID card or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to move to a ghetto or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to get in a cattle car or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to take a shower or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? At every step of the way, it was in their rational best interest to not resist. But I'll tell you something very important, which is the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. No, listen. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. Keep that in mind over the next 10 years. The problem is not merely false hope, but it's hope itself. I was doing a talk in Colorado several years ago, and I was gleefully bashing hope, and someone shouted out from the audience, "What's your definition of hope?" And I said, I don't know. I've been bashing hope for years, and I have no clue what I'm talking about, but I'm a white male, so I get to do that. And I said, so you tell me, what's your definition of hope? And they came up with a great definition, which is hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. Hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. And this is how we use it in everyday language. I don't hope that I eat something tonight. I have a candy bar in my backpack, and I know men are supposed to be afraid of commitment, but especially Sagittarius men, but I am going to commit to you here in public that I am going to eat this candy bar tonight. This is not, I don't have to hope, I eat it. On the other hand, I get on an airplane tomorrow, and when it's in the air, I hope it doesn't crash, because once it's in the air, I have no agency whatsoever. I can choose to make the flight or not make the flight. I can choose to eat a candy bar or not, but I can't choose whether it crashes. So when people say that they hope that that global warming doesn't kill the planet, what they're saying is that they have no agency. But it's pretty straightforward. If you ask any reasonably intelligent 7-year-old how you stop global warming that's caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas, this reasonably intelligent 7-year-old will say to you, stop burning oil and gas. If you ask any reasonably intelligent 35-year-old how to stop global warming caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas, this 35-year-old will probably give you an answer that benefits green high-tech consulting firms because the 35-year-old has been metabolized into the system. I mean, it's pretty straight up. It's pretty obvious. You know, it's like, okay, so let's say I go into my bathroom and I see that the water is on in the bathtub. And it is overflowing onto the floor. What should I do?
Turn the faucet, see if the faucet's on. If it is turned on.
It is on. Well, That is a very good answer, but I can also tell that you are not an environmentalist. Because if you're an environmentalist, what you would say is that I need to apply for a grant from the Pew Charitable Trust, and I can use this grant to then install solar panels on the roof that will run a pump to pump the water from the floor through a gray water system, and then will water a permaculture garden. And I have just succeeded in insulting every person in the room. And so the point is that people talk about, I don't hope that global warming doesn't kill the planet, and I don't hope that coho salmon survive. I will do whatever it takes to make sure the dominant culture doesn't kill the planet, and I will make sure, I will do whatever it takes to make sure that it doesn't drive coho salmon extinct. If coho salmon don't like how they're being treated and they want to go away, I will say goodbye and I will miss them. But if they don't want to go extinct, I will not allow the dominant culture to drive them extinct. I will do whatever it takes. I do not hope that coho salmon do not go extinct. It is customary, when speaking of the apocalypse, to end on a happy note. And I can't quite do that, but I will do my best, which is I'm going to read two very short things, one of which is the most beautiful thing I've ever written, and I actually didn't write it. It was written by a stream near where I live, by which I don't mean that I wrote it sitting by a stream. I mean that the stream wrote it. I had been trying to write about what it's like to be a river for several days, and I wasn't getting anywhere. And then I realized that it was really stupid for me to try to write about what it's like to be a river when I live 20 yards from a stream. This would be like me trying to write about what it's like to be a woman when I can just ask you. So I went down to the stream, and I said, what is it like to be you? And the stream had been waiting so long for a human being to ask that question. And I realized in that moment that this is the fundamental question in any relationship of any sort. What is it like to be you? And this is a question that we don't often ask, don't often enough ask. I realized at that moment I had never asked that of a human being, and no human being had ever asked of me. So anyway, I asked the stream, what is it like to be you? Told me the answer just like that. I went running through the forest back to the house to write it down and write down what it said. And as I'm running through the forest is going, hello, what's it like to be me? And so this is what they said. Pretend you're a river. Pretend you're the mist who falls so fine, so gentle, that nothing separates water and air. You're the rain who falls in sheets, explodes onto the ground to leave pox and puddles. You're the ground who receives this water, soaking it up, taking it in, carrying it deep inside. You're the cracks and fissures where the waters accumulate, flow, fall to join more water and more, and pools and rivers who move slowly through cavities, crevices, pores. You're the sounds and silence of water seeping or staying still. You're the meeting of wet and dry, the union of liquid and solid, where solids dissolve and liquids solidify. You're the pressure who pushes water through seams. You're the rushing water who bubbles from the earth. You're a tiny pool between rocks. You overflow, find your way to join others who, like you, are moving, moving. You're the air at the surface of the water, the joining of substantial and insubstantial, the union of under and over, weight and not weight. You're the riffle, the rapid, the tiny waterfall that turns water to air and air to water. You're the mist who settles on the soil. You're the plants who drink the mist, and you're the sun who warms and feeds them. You're the fish who feed on insects, who feed on plants, who feed on soils, who feed on fish. You're the fish who become soils, who become plants, who become insects, who become fish, who flow down the river. You're the river who joins other rivers, that become a new river as all the rivers and something else. You are the river. You don't stop at the banks where liquid turns to solid. You reach into the sky and into the soil. Water moves through rocks, comes up to form pools far from the fast flow where the rivers move together, seeps down to join still waters deep below the surface, waters who sleep and wake and sleep and mingle with the stones who are the rivers too. You are the river, who's married to the mountains you've known since they were young, who've given themselves to you as you've given yourself to them. You are the canyons you nestle into, each year deeper than the year before. You're the forests that give you their fallen trees, the meadows you flood and feed, and who feed you back their fruits and fine insects who fly to your surface to be taken in by the fish who, with their own bodies, again feed the meadows. You are the river who feeds the ocean, who feels the tides pushing and pulling against your mouth, the waves mixing fresh and salt. You are that intermingling. That's who you are. That's who you've always been. You are the river. You've lived with volcanoes and glaciers. You've been dammed by lava and ice. You carry log jams so large and so old they grow their own forests with you running beneath. You live through droughts and floods.
You are the river. You miss the salmon. You miss the sturgeon. You miss the ocean. You miss the meadows. You miss the forests. You miss the beavers and otters and grizzly bears. You miss the human beings. You're the river. You want them back. You want to feel the tickling of the sturgeon, the thrusting of the salmon. You want to carry food and soil to the ocean. You want to cover the meadows as you used to, and you want to give yourself to them, and you want them to give themselves to you as you've done forever and as they have too. Now, pretend you're a forest. You're the bark of trees and the hairy moss who hangs from them. You're the duff who becomes soil, who becomes trees, who becomes seeds, who becomes squirrels, who becomes owls, who becomes slugs, who becomes shrews, who becomes soil. You're the trees who cannot live without the fungi, who cannot live without the voles, who cannot live without the trees. You're the fire who cannot live without the trees, who cannot live without the woodpeckers, who cannot live without the beetles, who cannot live without the fire. You're the wind who speaks to the trees and the trees who speak to the wind. You're the birds who sing and the birds who do not. You're the salamanders, the ferns, the millipedes, the bumblebees who sleep on flowers waiting for the morning to warm you up so you can eat and fly on home. You too will live through drought and flood, hot and cold, and you too miss the salmon. You miss the owls, the grizzly bears. You miss the rivers. You miss the human beings. You want them all back. You need them back or you will die. And the last thing I want to read, very, very brief, is I want to mention a tradition of the Cheyenne dog soldiers. It's called the picket pin and stake. Before a battle, a few of the bravest Cheyenne dog soldiers would be chosen to wear sashes of tan skins called dog ropes. Attached to each dog rope was a picket pin normally used to tether horses. During battle, the pin would be driven into the ground as a mark of resolve. Once the pin was driven, the dog soldier remained staked to that piece of ground, even to his death. Retreat was no longer an option. The pin could only be removed when everyone was again safe or when another dog soldier relieved him of his duty. It is time. I've driven my picket pin. I'm staked out and willing to give in no more. Where will you drive your own picket stake? Where will you choose to make your stand? Give me a threshold, a specific point at which you finally stop running, at which you finally fight back. Stand with me. Stand and fight. I am one, we would be two. Two more might join and we would be four. When four more join, we will be eight. There will be eight people fighting whom others will join, and then more people, and more. Stand and fight. The questions before each of us now are, what are your gifts and how can you use them in the service of your land base? What can you do? What does your land base most need from you? How can you achieve it? What do you want to do? And right now, perhaps most important of all, what are you willing to do? People ask me all the time, what do you want us to do with all this analysis, all this information? And I always say the same thing, which is, I want you not to listen to me because I don't live here and I don't know how to live sustainably. I don't know how to live sustainably here. I'm doing a drive-by, you know? I got here last evening and I'm leaving when we get done. I'm not part of your community. And if you want to know what to do, ask other members of your community. And what's the nearest river? The Calumet?
Yeah.
So if you want to know what to do, you should ask the Calumet River because it will tell you what it needs. And then really the only question is, are you willing to do it? So thank you very much. Okay.